Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers. We are soldiers.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the Growing Conservative Conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find us at the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And also check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Check out our Get Involved page where there's some links up there for you to read and watch. There's also our Give page with some wonderful organizations that can definitely use your help, as well as some conservative ones, and I would appreciate as well, as I know they do, whatever contributions that you can give. And also check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk's new sponsor page. Now, tonight we have, congressional candidate James Carr on this evening. We'll be bringing him on shortly. But if you're listening tonight, or whether you're listening to the archives, you are a Twitter user, just put in your tweet, listening to Bard's Logic, and then copy and paste the link into the tweet, and then put in hashtag PJNet. And again, it's just type in listening to Bard's Logic, and then in the link, and then if you could put in hashtag PJNet. Thank you very much. And I said, whether you're listening live now, do it throughout the show, or whether you're listening to it on the archives. So without any further ado, I will be bringing in our congressional candidate for the Libertarian Party, James Carr. So thank you very much, James, for calling to the show. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
Oh, doing great. Doing great. Spring has finally sprung, at least here in our area. So it's good to finally see the sun and get some warm weather.
Yeah, I'm down here in Virginia, and we had that beautiful week of weather, and then we had a night where the frost came through and killed all the flowers everybody planted that first week. So I think we're finally over that and ready to move towards summer.
Well, I always recommend doing planting, and I never do any kind of planting myself until May 15th, because we here in Ohio have those problems as well with frost. So we'll go ahead and start off, as we did have another candidate. You may have heard of him. I don't believe he's no longer running. Actually, he's not no longer running, but he was also running for the 7th district there in Virginia. And he was that was Peter Greenwald. He was running against Eric Cantor in the primary for the GOP. And then there's still a primary race. We'll talk about later. So one of the things that we talked about with him is what motivated him to join the race. So we'll ask this the same as you, as I have every candidate that has come on. So what did motivate you to get in the race? Was it for certain issues that you'd like to bring out to the fore, or was it to open opportunities for voters to have more than just a Republican or Democrat option? Is it more than that, or any other reasons?
Well, yes, both, and even more. Quite honestly, I'm not a political person by nature. I'm not a politician, I should say. I've always paid attention to events. I've talked with many of my much more intelligent than me, you know, I will easily admit that, friends, and we've debated for years on a variety of topics for the fun of the debate. the idea of trying to come up with a better solution. And we always, well, it's easy to pick a political topic and take sides and debate it because, well, there's plenty of material there. So I'm a working guy. I grew up just outside of Richmond in a rather impoverished area. Went to a school system that did not have a lot of money, was actually one of the lower-ranked schools in the district I was in. Still made it to William & Mary. And I graduated from there, and I know anybody who happens to have seen the site, you know, this is the very basic bias stuff. It's very familiar. After William & Mary, I decided to tour around with a rock band because I didn't have a set goal. I didn't want to become a politician. I didn't go straight out of school and start working on a political campaign and then work in a lawyer's office and then become a politician for the rest of my life as some others have. Well, over the last several years, a lot has changed with my life. After college, rock band for a few years. I worked in the defense industry for a while. I've been in healthcare for several years. And with this, always paying attention to the political climate, what is going on, having these same discussions with my friends, and the discussions became more and more frustrated because you can't find a perfect answer without genuinely changing the way the system is currently operating. You have a two-party system where the only way to get a change is to give up something that you believe in. Now, I'm all about compromise, but we've got parties that are at such extreme odds, and I think the classification of conservative and liberal is arguable. I don't really like those terms. I think they're both slightly misleading. But I know that they're used very frequently, and everyone understands what the intent is. So we have, you know, I've had this discussion, how do you fix this system? And we kept saying, well, it'd be great if you could get someone in office who wasn't beholden to the two-party system power structure that has been put in place. And if you think back to the mid-1900s, this wasn't how it worked. You know, it was more about the caucuses in the Senate and the House. It wasn't the significant power of the party leaders basically dictating the platform of the party and, well, step in line, that familiar phrase, what side of the aisle are you on? So about 2 years ago, I started putting down a lot of my thoughts on a variety of topics. And not surprisingly, as I mentioned, I've been in healthcare for 7 years now. One of the topics that came to mind, you know, well before that, and I was having a hard time articulating to friends. I'd written a few white papers on the idea of true healthcare reform and why ACA was not a reform of healthcare. It was simply a new option for health insurance, and two very distinctly different terms most people commingle. So I said, I'm going to branch this out into more topics, and I had a blog, you know, just a personal blog. Well, last year, the Virginia gubernatorial race, I don't know if anyone paid attention to that, but I assume that you did. We had a Libertarian candidate run, and I actually didn't find out about that until very, very close to the election, because I was busy taking care of my children at the time. You know, it's a standard story. It's one of the reasons that people at my generation do not get involved in politics. They don't pay enough attention because life is happening around them. Most of them, unless you have dedicated your life up into this point toward being a politician, you let things slide so that you can handle what's going on in the day-to-day. Myself, I have a 3.5, he's almost 4-year-old boy, and I have twin 19-month-old girls. So at the time that all of this was going on, I had a 3-year-old and, you know, the 1-year-old girls. So we really didn't have a lot of extra time to to pay attention, to do the investigation that is really necessary to understand the political views of any candidate. I refuse to take anything that the media presents to you, regardless of what media you watch, as mm-hmm. being true. It's always very biased.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot on the show.
And not surprising. It's a very common topic these days, and it's really a shame. You used to be able to rely on the media to provide you with news with an unbiased opinion so you could educate yourself, and now it's more of a spectacle. So, the election's coming up, and I've found out that there is a libertarian running, not just a libertarian, but if you break libertarians into what a lot of people do, sort of a two groups. You have the sort of anarchists and you have the minarchists, right? And we had someone who lines up very closely with where I fall on that scale in Robert Sarvis. And with a very minimal budget, he was able to do something in the gubernatorial election that no one thought he had a chance of doing. And that's gained a significant percentage in a southern state for a third-party candidate. Well, that same time, we had one of the ugliest elections going on. And at every ad on television, there was nothing of substance being presented. What you were being presented with were ads that basically were meant to detract from an opponent and make you look good in comparison. It's a standard state of politics at this point, which is really sad. And I was getting very agitated. I was kind of on the edge of a decision. And one night we're sitting there, and my son looks up at the television, and he goes, "That man is cross." And he watches Thomas the Train, and that's sort of as close as you get to saying he's pissed. And I look up, and sure enough, it's a political ad. And I just could not take the idea of my son growing up and not understanding that the idea that you get to elect your officials, because these are people that are supposed to represent you. He's not going to see that. He sees it as, well, you pick the lesser of two evils and move on, or you know what? Why even bother? That's what the younger generation is coming up believing, because we've been in this state for so long. So it was actually election night last year that I decided
evil,
I was
whether it's lesser two evils, still voting for evil. But go ahead.
Fair enough. Well, it was election night, and I said I'm going to do this. And I've always considered myself an independent with libertarian views, just because I didn't like the idea of what I understood party politics to be. Again, I've never been a politician. I'm not a lawyer. I've got a financial education. I've been working in finance and analytics. So I wasn't sure exactly what it meant to become part of a party. So I started talking with Rob after the election, meeting with various people in the Libertarian Party, and found out that, yes, they are very open to people who have not necessarily been part of the party but share the same goal of minimal government. And so I went and said, this is what I would like to do. I already had most of my campaign strategy laid out, save the entry of an actual party nomination. So got the nomination in March, and right now working to get on the ballot. We're probably about a third of the way to the goal right now. I want to have at least 50 to 80% overage for the requirements from the state to get on the ballot.
Well, certainly they'll be challenged.
They like to throw them out. And Virginia is pretty notoriously strict on the petitioning rules. Getting on the ballot is the first challenge, because I want voters to have, like you said earlier, another option. And what we found out just recently, I don't know if you've been paying attention to this, but about a week and a half ago, the Democrats announced that they are not going to put anyone up in the 7th. So for Virginia's 7th district, it is either going to, there's an idea that it's going to be an uncontested race, because if you look at a lot of the blogs, the various journals out there, they say, well, the GOP primary is going to decide who is the representative in Virginia. And And I've taken exception to that because I think we can present a legitimate option, you know, a legitimate alternative. And as a libertarian, as someone who believes in minimal government in all aspects of one's life, there's a certain appeal to a lot of those sort of centrists. They may identify themselves as Republican, Independent, or Democrat, but they fall in that centrist. They don't believe that the government should be involved in every aspect of your life, but they usually vote against someone, not for someone. And I think we're going to have a very significant appeal to that group. I think there is a movement here, and it was just validated over the last about 5 days by one of the local papers. They have an online poll that has been getting quite a bit of attention. It says, who would you vote for Senate right now? And right now, Robert Sarvis is running around 60% of that. Now, we're in this paper's in a fairly liberal area inside the state of Virginia, which is notoriously conservative. So you've got a very interesting mix there. But it looks like more and more people are seeing that this third-party option is really viable, and that 2014 appears to be the year we can make a true difference in politics, not just put a different person in place, but put a different ideal in motion.
We can definitely explain some things we'll discuss later. We've talked a number of times on third-party options here on the show, especially in the past 2012 election. But let's move on to the issues. And the topic of the death penalty, while not on your campaign website, it is on another website, doing some research, seeing you have, called whyillnevergetelected.org. So two things.
Correct.
Tell us why you made that site, its purpose, and why you picked the title, Why I'll Never Get Elected. And then give us your opinions on the death penalty as it pertains to your thoughts, as you put it, to contributions to society.
Sure. You actually have found my personal blog that I referenced earlier that I started. I had started that on a different site, and I just transferred it over at some point last year. And up until this most recent version of my campaign website, which luckily a volunteer came along and said, hey, I know you took a swing at building a website. Why don't I help you out? And so he was able to come in, and Josh has done wonderful things with making my current campaign website much more functional. But I had a link on the old one because I didn't have my more in-depth write-up on where I stand on the issues. What I've found is most politicians, they give you one little blurb. Here's where I think, and it's something catchy, it's something they work, they probably A-B test, you know, for hours on end to find out what's the exact way I need to phrase this to get the best response. And for me, that's someone putting their best foot forward, but it's, in a lot of times, rather artificial. So I want the voters to hear my voice, and the truest way I could do that is to share my opinion on some of these rather touchy issues in depth, not just that I believe this, but here is why I believe that. And I've been working with Josh to transfer those blog entries over to my campaign page so that you would actually have everything available in one spot, not have to flip back and forth. So the topic of the death penalty. Yes, I wrote on that a while ago, and it's definitely one of my personal issue that people tend to get a little bit up in arms about. I am a death penalty supporter. I believe that there are cases where the death penalty is the only logical conclusion. There are crimes that are so profound, this member no longer needs to exist in society. They can't contribute to society, so you have the option of lock them up, throw away the key, spend millions of dollars over the course of their life giving them food, entertainment, having to pay people to guard them, making sure that the living conditions are suitable. Or you say, you have done something so profound to another human being And I use profound, not just taking a life, because if you've read that entry, I think there are a few other things that actually we would be able to apply the death penalty to. I don't know that the general populace would ever accept it, but if, you know, my ideal would be, yes, someone who is a child sex offender, they've actually damaged someone to such a degree, and these offenders, they get life sentences quite often. They're lock them up, throw away the key. Nothing good is going to come from that person existing at that point. I don't see it as an argument on rehabilitation. I see it as you need to remove a threat from society when the threat has proven to be a very real and significant threat and harms others, and the person has proved that they do not care to live in a society. So, yes, I have absolutely no problem with the death penalty. I do not think that it should be used lightly. There are some who have accused me of not caring at all for human life, and I think that that's the exact opposite. I think that most of these offenders you will find leaving them in society, or the resources that are spent trying to keep them incarcerated for their entire life could be better spent to actually rehabilitate nonviolent offenders and get them back into society as productive members.
Interesting. And we'll talk further on that during the roundtable discussion. But also another topic that's been in the news lately, especially the liberal news, is the minimum wage. Tell us what your thoughts are on raising the minimum wage, and do you think there ought to be what some are calling a living wage?
Well, I will say that I think the minimum wage is an extremely poor decision from an economic standpoint, and I also think this this idea of the federal government mandating it is outside of the government's purview. They're reaching into control markets. We're supposed to have a free market. We're supposed to allow the market to support what it can. And when you inject these I think they're rather arbitrary, quite honestly, and usually the idea of what they call a living wage, as with it, almost any term that you're going to bring up related to a political issue, someone spent a lot of time coming up with a very emotionally evocative term, because that sounds like something that you can't live without this living wage. And, well, the truth of the matter is there are millions of people who do live below what, ever arbitrary level someone is calling a living wage right now, and they do fine. They may not have everything that everyone else has. We are not a society where everyone gets to have everything they want. We are a society where you get to have what you work for. You have the promise of the opportunity to earn what you're able. You can go out there. Now, there are some exceptions over the history of the U.S., and I will say that when the minimum wage was first enacted, it was at a time in the U.S. where they thought that that was the only way to recover. You had some rather large disparities in the upper crust and the poor. I think those are always going to exist in any society. And government injecting itself into the market actually exacerbates the issue. It doesn't correct it. So if you look at it from how does having a minimum wage negatively impact these actual low-wage earners, what you find in most cases is if you raise the living or the minimum wage, we'll take a $5 minimum wage and you're going to bump it up to 7, or you could take a 10 and say it's going to be 15. If a higher minimum wage means people make more money, why don't we set the minimum wage at $100 an hour? And when you get to that point, everyone said, whoa, that's insane. You're going to distort the market. Everything's going to get inflated. And what they don't understand is that you're doing the exact same thing at a micro scale whenever you assess a minimum wage. It's just how quickly do you want to see the, you know, rather profound impacts of what you're doing. You can see them very quickly. If you set a minimum wage at $100, what happens? Well, the companies are going to have to cut.
Right. Speaking of cuts, President Obama, in his last State of the Union address, stated that there would be a minimum wage raise for federal employees. And that's definitely not conducive to slashing funding or things of that nature or restoring the nation's fiscal solvency. So as a congressman, what would you do? What would you cut from the budget?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear that. What was the question?
Oh, I asked. Of course, there would need to be budget cut. You know, budget cuts. You know, to bring down the deficit and, of course, bring down the debt. What would be some of the things as a congressman that you would suggest cutting?
Well, there are so many bureaucracies in the federal government right now that it's very difficult to know where to start. I was trying to find some solid data, and again, as not a politician, I don't have, I'm not independently wealthy, so I don't have thousands of dollars to spend on a campaign team that can go out and, you know, work full time on getting data for me. So I found the Federal Digital Archives and downloaded a few files off of there that are supposed to represent the budget. And when I'm looking at almost a trillion dollars. You know, budget for Medicare, about the same, a little bit less. Well, I think they call it human and health services. About the same for military spending. You're looking at some really large chunks of dollars there. Now, when you look at what we have coming up in the next 20 to 30 years, related to Medicare and how the baby boomers are aging, and we just started seeing the baby boomers get on, you know, eligible for Medicare and start to retire. We're having, you know, a lower number of people who are going to support a much higher number who are going to be on this government assistance. It's completely impossible to support it when you have lower dollars coming in and higher dollars going out. So what you really need to do to cut money is to start getting rid of some of these bureaucracies. And one of the first ones that I think, and I think one of the most effective ways to cut some of the budget is to look at Social Security and come up with an intelligent way to take that out of the government's hands and put it into the hands of the individuals. Get personal responsibility involved. So how do you do that? Well, we're talking, you know, some pretty large sums, and you know, I know my in-laws. They are both retired at this point, and they're living on a fixed income. Now, when I was talking with my father-in-law about this, he said, "Well, if you're going to cut out Medicare and just give it to some businesses, well, isn't that going to mean if the business isn't profitable that I'm not going to have any money to pay my bills?" I said, "Well, actually, it means you're going to be able to invest it." Look, there are states who actually allowed people to opt out of Social Security, and they are getting, I think, it's several times more than the return. I'm sorry, I don't have my numbers right here in front of me. Several times the return that Social Security gave them for the money that they put in it over the years. You take Social Security, and you divest the government from that entire practice of saving for your retirement because you don't know enough to save for your own. The government shouldn't be assuming that everyone is, you know, dumb or that everyone should. There are some people who say, you know what, I'm going to live and work up until the day that I die because I like working. That's what I want to do. And that is an absolutely valid choice. But the government doesn't let you do that because they're going to take that cut out of your paycheck. Before it even gets to you, they're taking their money. So if we're going to privatize this, how do you do that when you're talking about such large dollars and not disrupt those who are depending on this money coming in? Well, you also divest the federal government of these large-scale assets the federal government owns, the things that they've spent Social Security on instead of putting it into smart, you know, savings so that they can hand it back out. when it's necessary. They don't have an account with your name on it where every dollar that you put in sits there, gains interest, and they give it back out to you when you grow or when you get older, when you're able to retire. What they do is they take that money and they use it for all of these other things. They they increase spending across the board, and it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you are on. Everybody wants to increase spending in some area. So, well, we've got this nice steady income coming in from everybody. We're taking it out before it even gets to them. So they put it over, they use a little bit over here, they use a little bit over there, and then they realize they don't have enough to pay out Social Security. So what do? They start making reductions in your benefits. Because, we miscalculated. We're going to have to cut what you're getting. Government miscalculating. I did not know that could happen. But also, they've used it to acquire assets that the federal government was never intended to own. Just the sheer number of buildings and the amount of land that is under the control or owned by the federal government right now is...
Real quick, James, because you see it's actually the bottom of the hour already, and we did talk about at least some about land use and the government ownership of land with a Green Party candidate, actually, who was on a couple weeks ago, who's running for governor of Pennsylvania. But we're going to have to move on first with word from our sponsor. But first, if you're listening to the show either live or on the archives, just put in your Twitter user, just put in listening to Bard's Logic, and then copy and paste the link and put it there with the hashtag PJNet. That's PJNET. Again, just put listening to Bard's Logic, and then copy and paste the link, and then hashtag PJNet. But first, folks, May 11th is Mother's Day. For all you men listening to the show, visit our sponsor for some great ideas for your special woman on Mother's Day. And here is from our sponsor, Julie at Silpada. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Julie Stevenson, an independent representative with Silpada Designs. Silpada is a direct selling company which offers fine sterling silver and semi-precious gemstone jewelry. If you like sterling silver jewelry, you can place an order with me. If you love sterling silver jewelry, book a home show and get the pieces you love for free. Silpada hostesses earn an average of $300 in free jewelry and 3 half-priced items. If you love our jewelry, do what I did and become a Silpada rep and earn 30% commission as well as free jewelry monthly. It's so simple. The style of our home parties is always an open house with no formal presentation. You can access my website on Bard's Logic. Then call me to start living the life you deserve, 513-378-8876. I can't wait to hear from you.
So, guys, do not forget to visit the sponsor and listen to the archive, and also visit the sponsor page on bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com to get that special gift for Mother's Day. So now back to the show with James Carr. So next we'll move on to one of the topics you do have on your campaign website, and that is gun rights. So tell us your stance on those.
Well, I think the Second Amendment makes it perfectly clear. And for anyone who's been to events and happened to see where, I have to take my jacket off because it's a little hot, they'll see that I don't just talk the talk. For many years, I've been a concealed carry holder here in Virginia. I carry whenever it is legal and safe to do so. I do not open carry personally because I know that some people are a little uncomfortable with it. And while I'm very comfortable with guns, I have absolutely no problem. I do not wish to force my beliefs on anyone else. I also don't wish to make anyone unnecessarily uncomfortable. Yes, it doesn't make sense that they get that way, but, it just doesn't feel right to me if I get somebody, you can see the look on their eye where they say, why do you have a gun? Why do you have a tire iron in the back of your car? Not because you're planning on having a flat, but if you have a flat, you're going to need that. And I do not believe that there really is much of a differentiation between these large capacity magazines that people complain about. I can swap out a magazine, and I'm not very fast at it, but you can drop a 7-round magazine out and put a new one in under a second. So if I have a single magazine that has 15 or I have two that have 7, it really doesn't have a material difference in the outcome. What people don't focus on, they say, oh, we have all these mass shootings. What's going on? Well, it's not related to the gun. The gun did not go and kill anyone. The gun does not do that on its own. It is 100% related to this unstable population. You know, we have a society right now, and I think it goes a large degree to pointing out this frustration in the two-party system. It sort of builds upon this underlying irritation across America with the idea that, well, if you don't believe like I do, I need to convince you. I have to get you to believe like I do. And if you have someone who is, already mentally unstable, they have an argument, or there's usually some catalyst that sends them off. Now, we've seen cases where it doesn't have to be a gun. It's very easy to build a bomb out of household cleaners. You can't outlaw all of them. You're not going to fix crime by making it harder for law-abiding citizens to defend themselves. And there's a great sign I've seen around, and I can't I have to find it and send it to you, Robert. It's the which is better going to protect our children? It's the gun-free zone, no guns here, or it's our staff is well equipped to defend our children and will do so if they are threatened.
Oh, I think that definitely.
You have certainly seen that one. Okay, good. Because
I haven't seen it, but I agree with the second one because, I mean, by saying it's a gun-free zone, you're just telling those folks, oh, great, good, then I'm going to be the only one with the firearm here, so I'm going to be able to, go through this score, what have you, with impunity.
Right. Hey, if gun-free zones work, then I think Chicago would have the lowest murder rate in the country, right?
I've
seen those statistics. That doesn't quite pan out because criminals do not care how many laws you put in place. They're going to do what they want, and they will have access to guns. They will get them. If you outlaw guns, then all you're doing is creating a underground market that it's extremely profitable for someone to make that gun and get it out there, very much like the drug, industry as it is. If you talk about the war on drugs, what it's created is this underground drive. You did not have, before marijuana was criminalized, you did not have underground drug gangs selling marijuana and having gunfights in the street. That's purely a government-created situation. Because if you can go out and get it legally, then businesses are going to find a way to provide that to you. They're going to make a profit. That's what businesses do. But they're going to be doing it in a very legal way. And the criminals, they're going to be doing it for a much lower price than the criminals are selling these drugs for. So there's no incentive for the criminal to even get into that industry. You don't have the underground aspirin cartel. I've never seen that. If you do, please do send me the link if you've seen that. So the idea of, and with guns, it's the exact same thing. If you are going to take the guns off the street, well, what you're doing is you're taking them from out of the hands of law-abiding citizens that either use them for recreation or want them for personal protection, of their family, of themselves, or of friends, and you're leaving them open to criminals walking in and basically saying, I have a gun, you don't, I own you.
Right, I know we've got weapons strategically placed throughout the home here. So, but we need to move on in the interest of time. committee of some panelists who'd like to chime in. So let's move off the issues for a little bit and get to the campaign for a bit. One of the thing that seems common in every state is the stranglehold the duopoly of the Democrat and Republican Party has in the political process, especially in regards to the alternative parties. What difficulties, if any, have you faced so far in getting onto the ballot?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the biggest hurdles is actually the communication with the voters. And it's not an uncommon reaction. I know that before I was out petitioning, if I'm with my kids and I'm coming out of, you know, Sam's Club, and there's someone out there with a piece of paper asking me to put my signature on it, chances are I'm going to tell them, thank you, but, you know, I need to get my kids to the car, and I'm going to move on. Well, imagine needing to engage, and luckily, I'm just going for a House seat. If I had to go for a Senate seat or a gubernatorial election, you know, you have to have 10 times as many signatures. So for me, I have to get 1,000 signatures. Now, they have to be legible, so you're going to scratch off a quarter of them. I actually have been trying to keep a tally of what, you know, all right, what streets am I getting people involved in? I don't want to go send petitioners back to the same streets, and, well, there are quite a few that I just can't tell where this person came from. You know, can't tell what the name is. So you have, for me, I have to get 1,000 signatures. I mentioned earlier, I'm about a third of the way because, again, I work a full-time job. I'm not independently wealthy and able to not do that. So getting out and talking to people, engaging what I'm guessing is going to be about 1,800 people, enough that they are willing to put down personal information. You know, they have to put down their address, print their name nice and clear, and sign this form, putting their signature down on paper. There's a natural aversion to that with everything that we've seen going on with identity theft. It's a hard barrier to break. So you have to dedicate a lot of time, and with it's a very common theme, like you said, with the third-party candidates, that we're getting involved not because we're politicians. And so with that means you have a day job. It means you have other things that you have to do for quite a few of us. And it makes it hard to get out there, spend the time to really get people over to your side. So we're lucky enough that every once in a while we find a show such as this that is willing to actually come on and take a third-party candidate seriously, or at least seriously enough to have a discussion with us, and we can reach out to more people. And hopefully a few of these people are going to say, you know, even if I don't agree with every one of his views, maybe I don't agree with all of them, but I agree with the idea of options, then they'll go to my site, they'll send us an email and say, hey, I'll sign the petition, where are you going to be? Or they're going to show up at one of the events I have listed and sign the petition. Hopefully some of them are even willing to help volunteer. You know, if somebody's willing to sign a petition, well, maybe they can print one out and go get four of their friends to sign. Those four may be the four that put me over that 1,000 mark.
Well, I certainly want to see more choices for the people when it comes to voting. Definitely, I'm a big fan of the Irish political system, both with the way they do political parties as well as the way they do their actual voting. I think it's more representational for the citizens there. It'd be great if we could adopt something like that. I mean, I don't think that would ever happen. We even had a show on that. If anyone on the show listening would like to hear more about it, just look through our archives where we talk more about third parties and things of that nature. But also on your blog, you discuss campaigning by the numbers. So share with us your thoughts on that concept. And also you talk about Aaron Cantor as your opponent, but currently he is still in a primary battle with David Bratt. So would your strategy change if Bratt wins the primary race?
Huh, that's interesting because I haven't – all right, so we'll start off with the idea of campaigning by the numbers and why I don't know that anything really changes. And some people will say, well, you're completely naive. You don't understand politics if you think nothing changes. Well, I know there's going to be a change, but nothing's going to change in my message or how I talk to voters. And that all goes back to the campaigning by the numbers post that you referenced. So when I decided that I was going to do this. I said, I've got to figure out how do you even start to campaign. So I started looking up quite a few books on the topic. You know, it's, one of them was, I can't remember, it wasn't Campaigning by the Numbers, but something very similar to that. And the gist of it was, so you need to go out, find out who is in your district and the topics that are important to them and how they feel about them, and you need to go out there and spread that message. And it, what it didn't say is, if you agree with it. What it said is, you're going to tell the people what they want. That's how you get elected, period. And I have a very principled, it's almost like I can feel the bile rising when I think about politicians that are simply going to come up out here and tell us what we want to hear. And everybody knows that that is what happens. It doesn't make it any less offensive to me. I think the idea of campaigning on topics that you don't actually believe in simply because they will get you elected is truly offensive. You know, it's that lack of truth. The voters should be able to rely on what you have said, at that, you know, this is really who the person is, this is how they believe, and this is how they will act. I can give you a very firm example of how I'm planning to approach that. There's a group called U.S. Term Limits. I don't know if you've seen them. They're promoting a very specific idea, and they're getting candidates for elections to pledge on a very specific term limit, and it's 2 terms for Senate and 3 for Congress, which is actually the one that I've come up with and been talking with several people about. But they said, you know, most people will say, oh, I'll do that. They're getting people to actually sign a pledge. Any candidate who is willing to sign the pledge, send it in, and they will actually help discuss your, you know, promote your campaign. Well, I've already signed it. I'm waiting to get...
I remember when Virgil Goode was running for the Constitution Party for president in 2012. One of the things he was talking about that what he would do as president would get a constitutional amendment, or at least, you know, work on a constitutional amendment for term limits, which was something that was very attractive for me, at least to the candidate.
Yes, absolutely. And so what I'm planning to do is not only they want you to sign this, so they have it down on paper. You said you would do. Well, I'm not only doing that. I'm talking about it at just about every event. Term limits. It's one of my key issues. It's the way we help change the process. But I'm going to sign the pledge as soon as I find somebody who's going to sit there. You have to have somebody witness it to send it in. I'm also going to post it on my website. Here's the pledge that I just signed. Any other candidate, if you're serious about changing the process, get involved. Come do it. Come over here. Look at this group and what they're trying to do. All they're trying to do is hold politicians accountable to their actions, which we all should be accountable to our actions. So going back to the idea of campaigning by the numbers and just telling the voters what they want to hear to get yourself elected, like so many of these career politicians do, you know, it's not an approach I'm willing to take. So it doesn't matter to me if Bratt or Cantor win in the primary, because my message was actually laid out well before I started talking with people and finding out, you know, in the district, how many people really agree with this? That's why I went out as an independent with libertarian views, and I wanted to see how many people will start to sign on. And I got excellent reception. What it turns out is, most of these things that are frustrating me are frustrating the constituents of the 7th District, are frustrating the constituents of Virginia, and of the entire U.S., quite honestly. They're tired of politics as usual, and they're looking for a way to change it. But nobody knows how, and everybody that thinks they have an idea how are so stymied by the idea of getting involved. Because like you said, it's a steep slope to try to climb just to get on the ballot as a third party. And then talk about funding. That's a whole different ballgame. You know, funding for third party is non-existent, where you go up against someone, you know, Eric Cantor spent $7.6 million in the 2012 election, and he's on pace to be over 10 this year, I think. Well, I can guarantee you, as a third party candidate, I'm not going to raise $10 million to spend on the campaign. Nor do I want to. There's so many better uses of that money. But what I do want to do is get out there and tell the voters, here is how I would act if elected. And when I get up there, that's how I'm going to act.
So let's talk about your thoughts on the Constitution, and later we will have our panelist, who's also our constitutional expert, Kelly Mordecai, and he'll be asking more specific questions about the Constitution. Do you believe the Constitution is, some say, a living, breathing document, or as a congressman, would you adhere to a strict interpretation of it?
Well, that's interesting because the forefathers actually built the Constitution to be able to accommodate change. They put in there, we can amend, we can add, we can make this document accommodate, but only in circumstances so severe that it requires it. Now, what's great is they also said, and if we make these changes, we're able to pull them back out. So we decide we're going to change the laws for taxation. It's no longer going to be apportioned to the states. It's going to be direct. We were able to do that. Well, we're also able to take that back. We're able to get enough people together and to ratify the Constitution. It's not a small task. It shouldn't be taken lightly. That is a document that was meant to build the structure for this country and has suited us rather well for a while, if people will actually adhere to it. I think there are some very glaring cases here recently where there are those who find themselves or consider themselves above reproach and above the constraints that are actually there on paper. But if adhered to, I think it is an excellent document. The interpretation piece, when you say adhere to a strict interpretation, well, I don't exactly understand what that term means, because a strict interpretation is in itself a little bit of a conundrum. I know, and I just had a discussion with one of these friends I told you I used to debate with, one of the most intelligent people I've ever met, and we're both interpreting something in a very different way. The exact same thing, we both have very logical interpretations of a given topic. Neither of us could refute the other with a logical argument because there's an interpretation involved, and that's where it gets a little messy, because we can't go back and sit inside the minds of those that pen the Constitution and say, you said this, but there's this little gray area here. How do you mean that? And I think they meant it to be a little gray. They meant for there to be enough flexibility in that document that we need to be able to interpret it to apply it correctly. So unfortunately, I think, is where we get into problems when it's completely disregarded. Now, I'll say one of my big issues now is we are completely disregarding the Fourth. And anyone who thinks that giving up our personal freedoms for this illusion of safety that is provided by groups like the NSA, reading everything that you put online, listening to your calls, is fooling themselves. It doesn't make us any safer. What it does is what it's actually doing is it's giving ammunition to these terrorist groups, to other countries who are looking for a reason to point to why the American dream is not ideal, why this idea of freedom, you don't want that. Look what they do to their people. They are building armies based on what we're doing to ourselves. So anyone who says that it's okay if the NSA listens to everything I say, and right now I've already hit their list at least a dozen times since we've been talking the last 10 minutes. But anyone who wants to say that it's okay if you're not saying anything wrong, then you're fine. Well, wrong can be interpreted, especially when you give our chief executive the power to hold someone, to detain them forever, without accusing them of anything, without a trial, and there's no way to combat that. Well, once you've given that power to one person, regardless of whether or not they say they will use the power or not, you have just broken down what the Constitution was meant to protect against. And so I consider the Constitution to be a living, breathing document, but it should not be a very easily changed document. It should be changed as the overwhelming majority of the country sees appropriate, not a few politicians.
Okay, and I chose those words for a specific reason, and so with that being said, and you'll see how that develops, let's go back to the issues. And these are issues that are very important to our audience. And on your campaign website, you chose to feature your stances on abortion, gun rights, and marriage. Why did you choose those three topics to highlight on your website?
Oh, well, I chose three because, well, when I first set these up, I didn't have room for four. And then, as I said, Josh took the site, moved it over for me, and we're working on adding more of those issues. But those three in particular, one of the things I want to make voters very aware of, because I've been accused of so many things when I'm out here petitioning. I had one person accusing me of being a shill for the Democrats. I had somebody else saying, well, you're nothing but a Republican in disguise. So evidently I can't win for losing with some of these people. The idea of some of these issues is to show that what I'm favoring is individual rights. It's not government in one area of your life. You know, you can fiscal controls. We're going to tax and spend, but we'll let you do what you want in the bedroom. And it's not, well, we are going to control you on a social level, but, hey, we'll let you have your money. It is truly individual liberty in all aspects of your life. So I thought those three issues sort of, they cover what are the standard stances of the two-party system. And I don't think anyone that looks on there is going to confuse me for being part of either of those parties, unless they think I'm, you know, one of the very, very moderate factions of the party. And, well, actually, that's libertarian, really the ideal appeals to a lot of people who are in those moderate groups, because what they see is, you know, you've got this small government. We're not way out on the extreme on the liberal side where, okay, you know what, we're going to take half your paycheck and we're going to tell you what to do with it. We're going to spend it as we see fit. No, well, we may raise it here in the future because we're going to run out of money because we don't know how to plan. And, you know, on the extreme conservative group where it really reins in what it means to be socially acceptable. So I think the three issues illustrate that I'm not on either of those places on the spectrum.
And I definitely want to explore two of those because they are so important to the audience here. Now, your website reads on gay marriage, and I'm taking this from the last two paragraphs on there. It says, many of those opposing same-sex marriage use the, and you have this in quotations, traditional family argument. I've yet to hear a reasonable argument explaining how exactly the traditional family, which now includes multiple sets of families or many children of divorced parents, is any more loving or stable than a family of same-sex parents. I would be interested in someone presenting an argument that does not invoke religion in support of limiting this legal right just to see if it can be done. One final thing to close this entry. For those that will circle back around to a religious basis for this argument because you can find no other, why would you not be fighting just as hard to make illegal divorce for opposite sex couples as you prevent same-sex couples from marrying? It seems to me that the same core set of beliefs is being violated. So with that being said, as I said, that's from your website. Would you like to elaborate on any of that I just read? And what is the basis for your conclusions, especially regarding the family, the traditional family?
Oh, I think that sounds like an absolutely well-written piece on same-sex marriage there, personally, but I might be a little biased.
Well, you wrote that. Yeah, that's taken from your website, what you wrote.
yes. Sorry, little tongue-in-cheek. So the idea of a family has evolved over time. It naturally is going to. We are social beings, everything about our social interactions with each other has evolved over time. Now, there's...
Some would say devolved, but go ahead.
Well, I think we're a lot better than we were in the Middle Ages and than we were living in caves. So I definitely think we have evolved as a race. I think we've done, many great things. And I think the core piece to my belief is that I don't know what's better for anyone else. I'm not going to force my beliefs on someone else. And I'm not going to let them force their beliefs on me. I am absolutely willing to have discussions. And that's why a lot of my posts, you'll see I have this, I'm very interested to hear what your opinions are. I want to know what other people are thinking, because if I have a flaw in my logic, then I want somebody to point it out to me, and I'm going to incorporate
We're definitely happy that you're open to that. We'll definitely have more discussion on that as the panelists and the audience come in. Go ahead.
Yep. No, so I want to hear these different opinions, but I will say that I do have a very personal connection to the issue as well. So my youngest brother, he actually met his now husband, and they've been together for years. Last summer, they had to fly across the country. They lived in Alaska at the time. Actually, they're there now, and they're getting ready to move to California. But they flew across the country and drove up to Maryland to get married because they couldn't get married anywhere else. They could not share that official connection. And there are a lot of people who say, well, why does it have to be marriage? Make it a civil union. And what the difference in the term, well, there's, to me, as long as there's no legal difference, it doesn't offend me, but it offends them. And why would we do something to offend someone when there is no difference? There are people who say, well, but it should be opposite sex. Well, why? What is the core reason that you think it should be opposite sex that is defined as marriage and then same sex as a civil union? I haven't had anybody who is able to say, here's a reason why, and it doesn't say, well, because it's in my religious doctrine.
And I think we'll definitely have some folks on who will be talking tonight who will address that. Hopefully they'll give some insights that you said you're open to. And so we'll move on to the next issue, and then we'll bring in Kelly Mordecai, and then we also have Dan in as well as our panelists to chime in. But first, we'll go to my last question here before we bring them in, and that's on the other issue that's very important to my audience, and that's on abortion. And I also take from the last two paragraphs from that as well. And it states, I have tried to define a societal impact of an abortion, but have found none. If we should only regulate social issues that impact others and are not able to define an impact to society as a whole, which would override individual freedom, the issue of abortion hinges on the last question above. And I guess that's when life starts. When does life start? This is one of the most debated topics in history in every discipline. The philosophical debates alone would fill a library. I prefer to use a medical/scientific reasoning when possible. In this case, there are several developmental stages during the gestation of a fetus. Along the way, features develop which would be associated with a definition of life for some. My view is that until the fetus has a reasonable chance to survive outside the womb, it is not considered as an individual on its own. Therefore, it is optional for a woman to continue carrying it. This roughly equates to the 24th week, and I'm interjecting here, that's 6 months, of pregnancy according to most medical journals. While the survival rate of a fetus delivered at 24 weeks is very low, this is the first point in the developmental process where it is even a remote possibility. Prior to this point, I do not think there is an impact to another individual that should outweigh a woman's right to make a decision about having a child. You would argue that the time frame should be a few weeks one way or the other, but it does not impact the overarching view that abortion is, in my view, a medical procedure. Point in the development of the fetus has no impact on others. Even after the 24th week, any risk to the woman's health should take priority over that of the fetus unless she decides otherwise. The decision should be entirely up to the woman with input from her caregiver. So some would contend abortion is not a religious issue, but more of a constitutional issue and not a social issue. Because, of course, you know, what's the first, you know, some of the first words is life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And so with that being said, let's go ahead and elaborate on your points on that, if you'd like to elaborate anything with what I just read, and then we'll bring in Kelly and then Dan. Go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, there are several people who have had these brilliant quotes on the situation, and I think it was Gary Johnson who had the one that I most respect. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember the exact quote, but it's, "I don't think anyone likes the idea of abortion." It's not a fun topic. But I think it's a decision much better suited for a woman and a caregiver than for a bunch of bureaucrats in Washington. And so it's part of that core idea of smaller government, you know, people making decisions for themselves, not taking, you know, not having bureaucrats dictate how we can live our lives. Now, there are some who are going to say, well, you're not protecting the unborn, and we, you know, then we get into the argument, well, at what point is there? Is that the unborn? Now, I've been attacked for my position on abortion for years, and I'll tell you the most recent one that actually was very interesting. They said, well, you know, it's not a right that you're giving women. It's a right that you're threatening to take away. It's their right. It's their body. Up until the point that the cord is cut, they can do what they want with this growth in their body. And that's on the extreme on one side. So then you go to the extreme on the other, and it's, hey, at the moment of conception, which actually nobody's going to know exactly when that is, you can obviously there's going to be a scientific definition of, you know, when the cells have joined and you have a zygote and et cetera. You can go through the biology books and see exactly when conception starts. But nobody's going to know that for practical purposes. So then, you know, if you say, well, any harm done to that being after that conception, well, then every, you know, a mother goes out and has a glass of wine and miscarries. You just say, well, you just killed your child. And I don't think that that's a reasonable approach. So you have to
And I would agree with that because, of course, you know, because I've heard that if a woman gets pregnant, it's usually within an hour of, well, we all know how women get pregnant. so, you know, within an hour, if it's her ovulation period or what have you, that's when, if she's get pregnant, that's when it is, and that's when conception begins. And some, including myself, would contend that that is when life begins, human life begins, because if it grows to its maturation to being born, I mean, whatever people want to call it is in there, it's not going to grow into anything but a human being. You know, I mean, it's not going to become anything else, but if left to its maturity, it's going to let, you know, when it's born or goes through the birthing canal, you know, it's not going to be anything but a human being. But
there's no one that would argue that.
But I
do have to point out something. You said it's going to become a human being. That is a very important distinction. It's not going to become anything other than a human being, and I do not debate that. It's the point at when that becoming is actually realized that I think
I mean
we're kind of debating here.
Saying that, you know, what's inside a woman, okay, when it comes out through the birthing, I mean, the birth canal, it's, you know, it's not going to be a dog, it's not going to be a cat, it's not going to be it's going to be, you know, what people would say, it's already human. I mean, it's not going to be any, okay, let's bring it back then. You know, even while it's inside, she doesn't have a dog in her, she doesn't have a cat in her, or whatever, it's a person. But hey, we'll talk about that later. Will you go ahead before I bring in the callers?
Okay.
So go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt you, but still go ahead and finish your point.
No, I think that we're it's the classic impasse. It's where does that definition begin? And it's also, like I mentioned earlier, where I have some of the most intelligent people that I know, and we've argued a variety of points, and we've actually taken opposite sides just because. And it's all about interpretation, and I think you've got some of the smartest minds in the world have come up with widely different interpretations on this exact subject. So it's not one that I think anyone is going to come up with the perfect answer. They're going to come up with what they think is the perfect answer, and for them it may be. But the important thing to remember is that perfect answer is not the perfect answer for everyone. And if we want to promote individual liberty, we have to understand that those ridiculously disparate positions are equally valid for the individuals that have them, but not for those who do not.
And with that, folks, I'll go ahead and bring in Kelly. So thank you very much, Kelly, for coming into the show. How are you? And I see Dan, we have some other guests on the line. I'll be bringing you in as well. But go ahead, Kelly.
Well, thank you, Robert and Jim. I'm really glad you're here. I lived in Maryland, Laurel, Maryland, and the East Coast is a little different from the West Coast. I'm out here in California, a.k.a. FEMA Region 9, a.k.a. the state of Jefferson, where we now have 250,000 residents. And you consider the four counties that are voting yes on this. I've been rather inspired by your Second Amendment stance. In fact, you know, you said guns don't kill people. People kill people. It's, you know, I'm going to my guns right here. I just happen to have them here. I'm pulling them out, as you can tell. I'm going to do a little experiment here. I got to open my gun case. It's my mini arsenal. Wait a minute. Here, let's see. All right, I got one half. All right, here we go. I'm getting it open. All right, guys, here's my guns. Guys, go kill someone. Well, at least go and talk to my client that hasn't paid me about $800 in 3 months. Would you like, guys, go. They're sitting there. They're not moving. Oh, my gosh. The guns, they're not moving. You know, okay, let's go to my ammunition box over here. I got to find my ammunition box here. Let's see here. Oh, here it is, right here. Let's see, I got a bunch of 30 calibers. I got a shotgun. I got 22. I'll open it up here, as you can tell. There we go. All right. Get out with the guns. Go tell my client that you're not even listening to me. You're just sitting there. What? Okay. Anyway, that's just kind of a joke.
You're
always
good for some humor there, Kelly.
Yeah. I mean, So I guess it's true that it's people that kill people. Oh, goodness. All right. Anyway. All right. So Jim, I want to go ahead. Oh, by the way, I too am a libertarian, registered libertarian. I went to the National in 2012. Maybe I'll see you this year in Columbus.
Go to Columbus, let me know, Kelly. It's only a 3-hour drive from where I live. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to meet you personally. And let's see, state convention a couple times here in California. So IR1. And this is a consistent theme. They love the Second Amendment, and then there's social issues that are, well, interesting. But I want to take you, Jim, through or Mr. Carr, I should say, or maybe I should pull us. Are you okay with either? Or?
I've been called much worse, so yeah, I'm fine with either. You know, I think
okay.
Most people call me James. A few people call me Jim. And a few people call me things I won't repeat here.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's a Sarah Palin moment. You know, can I call you Jim? All right.
Anyway. Sure.
anyway, all right. I want to help you with something. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take you through a quiz. And I, you know, respectfully, I think we'll have fun with this, but I want to help you with your campaign.
Okay.
Okay? And I'm going to go through this quiz with you. And at the end, I think you're going to understand where I'm coming from, because you're basically running for Congress, right?
I would say more than basically.
Yeah, more than basically. Oh, and by the way, at your lunchtime, go to your local post office. Every day, that's the way to get a whole bunch of signatures. Like local supervisor did that, and he got elected. All right. Anyway, all right. Let's start this quiz. And again, It's going to help you. Okay?
Okay.
I call this the state sovereignty quiz. Okay? I know I'm kind of flanking you here, but it's really important. And by the way, people who are listening, grab a piece of paper or a pencil, click notepad on your computer. I don't care. Let's just see how people do. All right, question number one. True or false? The Delaware coin reads, the first state, 1787. So true or false? Delaware became a state in 1787.
1787?
Yeah.
I would say false.
Next question, multiple choice. What year did the 13 colonies become states? A, 1776. B, 1778. 87 or 1788?
It was 87, wasn't it?
87? Okay, we're going to go through these quick. Actually, the colonies became states in 1776 through the unanimous Declaration of Independence, July 4th. These United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And I'm citing the Declaration here. And that as free and independent states, they have full power to wage war, conclude peace, contract alliances, and to do all other acts and things which free and independent states may have right to. So, sorry, you got that one wrong. All right. You got the first one right, though. All right. 13 colonies became states in 1776. True or false? In this country, we have a system of dual sovereignty, states versus the feds. True or false?
False. We have the state sovereignty. There's nothing that declares the federal government sovereign, is there?
I have to refer you to a court case, Prince versus U.S., which is the famous Sheriff Mack case. Justice Scalia penned, in this country we have a system of dual sovereignty, states versus the federal government, keep each other in check.
Okay.
So,
nothing originally stated, but based on a Supreme Court interpretation. Okay.
We'll get there.
Okay.
Okay. You might consider the Constitution really as a treaty between the states.
Hmm.
All right. Number four. I want to try to get through these real quick. And this will help you. Just got to hang on a little bit. All right. Multiple choice. How many colonial legislatures approved a state constitution prior to July 4th of 1776? A, 2, 4, 6, or 8 colonies.
Well, my history teacher would absolutely be appalled. I will say 4.
Very good. So
maybe she would
have yeah, he got it. He nailed it. That's awesome.
I didn't even know that one,
answered.
Charlie, up a minute. I didn't know that one.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm going to put a big happy face next to number 4 and next to number 1. All right. Yeah, New Hampshire in January 76, South Carolina in March. June was Virginia, and the colonial legislature of Jersey or New Jersey was on July 2nd. By the end of 76, 4 more colonies that had become states had their state constitution approved. All right, number 5. How long did the Union of States operate without an official name? 2, 4, 6, or 12 years?
I'm going to go with 6.
6?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. The answer was 2. They declared their independence on July 4th. On July 9th of 1778, the Articles of Confederation were ratified. Article 1, this union of states shall be called the United States of America. Now, what held them together before was our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. So they had a union, but they didn't have an official name until 2 years later. All right. Number 6, true or false? In 1783, King George of England acknowledged the statehood status of the 13 original colonies.
False.
False. The correct answer is true. The Treaty of Peace, or the Treaty of Paris, 1783, they wrote it in viz, which is a real classical Latin meaning, here is a list. And he listed all of the 13 colonies as states, acknowledging their sovereign statehood status. And so that happened in 1783. All right. So let's see. Number 7. True or false? If only 8 states ratified the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation would have remained in effect until a constitution was properly ratified.
False. Wasn't there an escape clause of sorts?
It took 9 states to ratify the Constitution. That's in the Constitution, by the way. Once 9 states ratified the Constitution, and then other states could join if they so chose, the authority of the federal government to the Constitution came from the states. All right, number 8, true or false? To amend the federal Constitution, it takes 2/3 of the states ratifying an amendment.
I thought it was 3/4.
You're close.
I think false. I'll say false.
You are correct. It is 3/4. 2/3 calls it, 3/4 ratifies it. So that was a happy face right there. All right.
Yeah.
Number 9. Okay. How long did the States United operate without the present constitutional government? A, 2, B, 4, C, 8, or 12 years? 8. Actually, 12 years. They became states in 76. Constitution ratified in 1788. So 76, 88, that's 12. Yeah. All right. So it's leading to where I'm going with social issues at the federal level. All right. Thought question. Who created whom? Did the states create and authorize the federal government? Or did the federal government create and authorize the states?
Well, obviously as a libertarian, the states, and not just a libertarian, as an individual that believes in individual liberty, the states gave authority to the federal government to exist.
Correct. Happy face. The federal government wants you to believe that they're the end-all, be-all of everything. When the states created the federal government, they had to ratify the Constitution, they ratify the amendments, the very authority or treaty in which we operate as a country came from the states ratifying it. All right. Number 11, we're getting closer to my point. All right, here's the thought question. I have to explain this a little bit, then we'll go with the question. Thought question. Many of the founding fathers held a strong faith in God and even penned divine providence and nature's God in the Declaration of Independence. Most read the Bible. Several founders were ministers and didn't support abortion or homosexual marriage in their personal views. They could have put social issues into the Constitution to prohibit said social behavior. Here is the thought question. Why did the founders leave social issues out of the Constitution?
The main goal of this United America is to support individual liberties and have the minimum government necessary to allow them those liberties without outside forces coming in and enforcing their will. They left social issues out because it does not belong at a federal government level. Those decisions belong with the individual.
Very good answer. I've been studying this. I mean, by the way, these are all historically researched. We've talked about it on the show. Hopefully the list has got most of these right. Our personal liberties, okay, our daily choices are infinite, okay? How we relate with others are essentially limitless. If we have a good conscience, we follow it. We don't harm anybody else or property or their rights. There really is no need for government. However, once the door is open for the federal government to regulate our personal lives, that is the day we have given a blank check to the federal government to grow to infinity. And I think the founders understood these principles, and that's one of the reasons, arguably, why they didn't put social issues into the Constitution. The states would handle their social issues in whatever way they seemed fit, but they didn't want the federal government to grow to infinity. So they purposely kept social issues out of the Constitution. Is that kind of your understanding?
Yes. Yes, the idea of you're not supposed to have a government to protect you. The Constitution is not written to protect. It's written to protect the individuals from the growth of government, not to provide a government to protect the individual, if you will. That makes sense. It's more of a restrictive approach on what the highest amount of government that these states would allow.
Right, and different states had different social laws. Connecticut outlawed abortion, for example, even until the 1950s, I think. The way I see social issues, see, if I were to run for Congress, I'll say it this way. This is how I'm trying to help you.
Mm-hmm.
It's Harry Brown's approach. You remember Harry Brown? He wrote Liberty A to Z. Yep. He was the two-time presidential candidate for president, okay? He wrote, look, I'm pro-life, but the federal government has no business doing this. I have told my local Tea Party, look, federal government doesn't belong in the womb, the bedroom, or the vein. Because once you give the feds the power in our personal life, they will grow to infinity. And they're starting to get that. And so what I'm saying is social issues, if I were running for Congress, I'd say, look, social issue, that's a state's rights issue. That's a state sovereignty issue. And let the states decide whatever they want. Why should mass,
right.
You know, for example, all right, let's suppose Nebraska is quite conservative. They have long marriages. Suppose Nebraska says, you know what, abortion is now illegal. Okay, let's suppose they do that. So they dictate through the federal government to California, you can't have abortions. They're using the federal government to manipulate a whole other state. Should Massachusetts tell Texas through the federal government, Texas, you have to bend over and accept homosexual marriages? It is
Ohio is trying to do that. Oh, well, there's a judge in Ohio that's trying to do that. Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is in these social issues on the federal level, the highest moral stance is to respect the sovereignty of the states. That's where I'm coming from.
I understand exactly where you're at, and I'm actually you brought up another issue that I think is important to understand when talking about a lot of these broader, very important topics, is the idea of precedent and interpretation and how they combine to be a very powerful force, because a legal precedent being set gives the ability for any other justice to step outside of his duty to interpret a case in front of him and just say, well, there's a precedent, I'm going to go with that. And it's one way that you've seen a lot of, especially when they are politically charged topics, a lot of justices not really weigh in with their own opinion, but just reference someone else's opinion and move along. It's just an interpretation. It's a very intelligent interpretation. I'm not trying to say that most of the justices do not have a very well-established understanding of the law, and clearly I would say a much better understanding of the Constitution, as you've just proved with your little quiz here. What I get, 30% maybe, if I'm lucky? You have people that have made interpretations on some of these topics that can go different ways. But once that legal precedent exists, it's very difficult to overturn that, you know, at a variety of levels. That's, you know, we have the appellate system, obviously, but once you get to a certain point, that you think Roe v. Wade set a precedent for the federal government being involved in the this particular social issue.
And real quick, gentlemen, we'll continue the discussion, but I do see it's about the hour, and I have a couple things that needs to be done before we move on. But first, of course, if you're listening here live or on the archive, and want other folks to listen in as well, just put in listening to Bard's Logic in your Twitter, if you are a Twitter user, and then put in the link by copying and paste it, and then put in hashtag PJNet. That's listening to Bard's Logic, then copy and paste the link in there, and then hashtag PJNet. And also, we all know that May the 11th is Mother's Day. So for all the men listening out there, listening to the show, if you just came in and didn't hear earlier, you can visit our sponsor for some great ideas for your special woman on Mother's Day. And so here is a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Julie Stevenson, an independent representative with Silpata Designs. Silpata is a direct selling company which offers fine sterling silver and semi-precious gemstone jewelry. If you like sterling silver jewelry, you can place an order with me. If you love sterling silver jewelry, book a home show and get the pieces you love for free. Silpata hostesses earn an average of $300 in free jewelry and 3 half-priced items. If you love our jewelry, do what I did and become a Silpata rep and earn 30% commission as well as free jewelry monthly. It's so simple. The style of our home parties is always an open house with no formal presentation. You can access my website on Bard's Logic, then call me to start living the life you deserve. 513-378-8876. I can't wait to hear from you.
So guys, do not forget to visit the sponsor page on Bard's Logic Political Talk to get that special gift for the woman in your life. So back to the show, and at this time I am going to bring in our other panelists. Thank you very much for holding, Dan. Thank you for coming into the show. How are you? There you are, Dan.
I'm using Skype for the first time tonight, and I'm on a microphone. My kid set this up for me, and I really don't know what I'm doing. Does it sound like a clear audio to you guys?
Yeah, so far.
Oh, good, good. I'd like to thank Mr. Carr for coming on tonight. It's always a pleasure to listen to different points of view in the political arena. Mr. Carr, I'm just curious. There is an Elon Carr running in California for the House, a Joe Carr running in Tennessee for the Senate, a Tim Carr running in Oregon for governor, a Marine Carr in Maryland's Anne Arundel County running for the county council, and a Brian Carr running in Texas for Lubbock City Council. Is this some kind of vast car conspiracy? Are you related to these people?
Well, I can say not that I know of. And, well, I guess my Car for Congress bumper stickers are a little more applicable than I thought.
Okay. I happen to have met a candidate for governor here in Pennsylvania named Ken Krawchuk. And in a borough, I've mentioned this before, not too far from us, a libertarian, Sean Felty, was actually elected to their council. Now, you said that $10 million is too much to spend on a campaign when Americans spend $8 billion a year on just shoes. And I'm impressed that only 1,000 signatures are required to run for Congress. It's a very different story here in Pennsylvania. Virginia's rules are pretty fair. With 1,000 signature minimum, I'm surprised why there aren't a dozen people running for Congress. I'm glad you are. But let me ask you, I have other questions, but having listened to you, are you running so that you can change the debate and promote libertarian ideas, or are you running to win?
No, make no bones about it. I am running to win. As a matter of fact, as I alluded to when I first came on, I wasn't initially running as a libertarian candidate. I had actually declared as an independent with libertarian ideals. I do believe that the Libertarian Party has an excellent stance and has the potential to make a difference. But if they did not agree with me, if they didn't think I was maybe, you know, an appropriate candidate. As I said, I wasn't sure how the party system would accept me. I was still going to run as an independent because I want to make a difference, and I believe that I can.
Okay. That's a fair answer. Now, I don't think that you really answered directly. You talked about a lot of the philosophy behind opting out of Medicare and restructuring Social Security when Bob asked you about budget cuts. And looking at your background as a senior cost analyst for large government projects and then moving into your current career doing healthcare finance, business systems, and advanced analytics, I understand that you're a person who parses the numbers. And since Congress is the place where spending is initiated, or at least it's supposed to be, I would like to ask for some direct on-the-record answers to what you would cut out of the budget. And I'm going to just suggest a number of things that just occurred to me that you may or may not agree with. You might have others. Why do we have a federal Department of Education? Why is the federal government spending money on Common Core? Why is there an Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division that really does nothing positive except go after, I mean, unless you think going after Tea Party people is a positive. Why do we have an IRS? And why are we giving foreign aid? Again, these bills come out of the House to China. Why are we giving foreign aid to Russia and weapons? Why are we giving foreign aid to jihadis overseas in Syria? So would you cut any of those particular programs? If so, great. If not, what would you cut?
Wow, you well, you're making this easy for me because you're kind of providing a lot of the answers ahead of time.
Well, I'm giving you what I think. You can agree or not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what I'm saying is I agree wholeheartedly. I had a very in-depth discussion with one of my supporters about a week and a half ago on Common Core and how detrimental the idea of the Department of Education and its continued grasp for control over the minds of our youth is. Quite honestly, the Department of Education, you could handle that with a few people who are basically going to be a reporting organization, and they're going to report on how the states are doing on a long-term. Imagine getting rid of Common Core, getting rid of standardized tests, getting teachers back to what they got into the business of education for. And it is a business. You go, you provide something. I'm very willing to pay someone to help educate my children so that they have a significant chance at success in life. I don't want to pay a wasteful federal government to try to indoctrinate my children with what bureaucrats see as important, because quite honestly, most of what they're teaching is this rote memorization. Now, I'm a numbers guy. I am not a rote memorization guy. Well, and I think Kelly proved that pretty well with a little quiz. And if you're gonna get me on dates, yeah. Well, you're gonna get me every time on that, because rote memorization has absolutely, no place in my brain. I will remember facts, but I am not going to remember facts that do not have a bearing on some of the issues that I'm talking now. Now, if I went and did research because I knew we're going to be talking about, when did X take place, I'm not a dumb guy. I would have probably remembered, a few more of those, maybe. But more important is learning critical thinking skills, learning how to think, learning how to find the answer. We live in a digital age. I actually don't need to memorize, a string of dates. I can go, as long as I know how to find them, as long as I know why those dates were important, education needs to get back to that critical thinking. So,
Mr. Carr, I think our audience has a very good grounding in critical thinking. So, without giving any suggestions as to how you might conduct your campaign, what people are looking for are principled politicians, and they're looking for answers that they can understand, but that are not just great long explanations and philosophical dissertations, but specific one-sentence answers. So I'm going to just ask you some yes or no questions. This is a quiz I guess I'm making up off the top of my head. It won't be as good as Kelly's. Would you cut the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education funding completely as a representative in the House?
Assuming that we are able to get rid of Common Core and give the states control, you know, give it back to the states and then back to the localities, back to the parents, then
okay.
Yes, I believe the Department of Education is not the best way to use those funds. I actually believe that they should, those funds redirected to the states would be much more effective.
Would you cut the Department of Energy?
Yes. I do believe that there are, if you look at the subsidies that are out there right now for business, business that would survive very well in a free market environment. Hell, I don't go out and buy CFL light bulbs or LED light bulbs or whatever somebody says is going to save me, you know, X number of kilowatt hours a year because the government says that I have to. I do it because it's a good decision for our personal finances in the house. And quite honestly, I like the idea that I'm using less energy. I want to minimize my, you know, footprint. I'm not doing it because the government tells me to. I like the idea. There are some people
who
say...
Just as an example, because you brought up CFLs, the whole reason why incandescent light bulbs have been basically made illegal in this country had nothing to do with saving energy whatsoever. They don't save energy unless you leave them on for long periods of time. So if you have a light that's going to be on all the time, you definitely have an energy saving. But when you switch them on and off, it reduces the effective life of the CFL bulb and makes the cost actually in many cases more expensive than regular incandescent. And the energy usage is more than offset that argument by the fact that incandescent bulbs, if they break, the worst thing you have to worry about is cutting your foot if you don't get the glass up, whereas the CFLs contain mercury, which is a toxic metal, which you really don't want broken on the floor of your house, especially if you have little kids, which you mentioned you have some precious little ones yourself.
Yes.
In any case, listen, again, I can't really give people advice, although I do it anyway. If you put one word or one sentence positions on your website, you know, and don't limit yourself to three, I will do this, I won't do that, this must go, this must stay, with a link, and you have your computer genius guy who can help you with this, to another page where you can write a whole 1,000-word explanation as to why you believe what you believe, that might work better for you. I have to tell you, listening to the first hour of the show was fascinating. I love philosophy and political discussion, but we're in a time in this country right now where nobody has the time with all the competing different bits of media that are trying to get our attention. And quite frankly, most of the listeners, not to this show, we've got some real sophisticated people, but most of the people out there, they're just waking up now, and they really don't have a good fact-based or philosophically-based grounding in the true reality of politics. But they have a sense of what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's not, and they're generally very accurate. So they're looking for somebody who says those things with real candor that jibe with what they believe. They're looking for you to educate them. And it's not going to start with 1,000 words. It's going to start with a sentence. Now, I'd like to move on to a couple of other things you mentioned. Guns. You talked about having a gun permit. I'm just wondering, as a future possible congressman in the United States House of Representatives, do you believe we should have a permit for other rights like speech or assembly or worship?
You know, I don't agree with the idea of a concealed carry permit, but I am a law-abiding citizen. Even if I feel that the laws are unnecessary. I believe that they're actually contradictory to a right that we're given, but there's a risk involved in not obtaining that permit, and it's one that I did the assessment. I said, I do not want to assess that, you know, accept that risk. So I go get a permit.
The risk of getting arrested
getting arrested, getting thrown in jail, ruining any potential that I had going forward. So I have to
I'm not arguing that you shouldn't have a permit or should, but as a future possible congressman, would you vote to make it a national law that permits are not required, that instead of it being a right that is granted to you by the government, which is in effect what it is right now, it's a freedom that you have that the government cannot curtail without due process based on a crime. In other words, I can speak any way I want to in this country right now, thank God, and I do thank God that I have that right yet for as long as we have it to say what I want to say. Now, they can't do prior restraint. They can't say that I might go into a theater and yell fire and cause a stampede and people might get crushed. However, if I do it, I can certainly be prosecuted. They cannot say, you know, Dan, you're a pretty rabble-rousing guy. You might incite a riot one day. However, if I were to incite a riot, they would have a specific legal tort. They would have damage that they could prove to society, and they could take it to a grand jury. They could have a trial with a jury and see if I'm convicted or not. Another thing is this. In many cases, and all the guests have been mentioning court cases, we have judges who are supposed to interpret another word that's been used by all the guests, including yourself and Bob, the Constitution and the laws as written. When judges interpret a law beyond the clear intent of the lawmaker, because that is their duty, is to say, what did the legislature intend when they wrote this law and the executive signed that they agreed with this and it became a law? Do you think that it's proper for the legislative branch to slap them back into their place just as they slap the legislative branch back into its place when it oversteps? In other words, when the judiciary declares that a right exists that you didn't write into the law, or declares that it doesn't, or interprets it in a way that clearly has nothing to do with statute, should the House of Representatives simply pass a law and say, you have no power in this regard?
Okay, so you had a couple of questions there, and I'll answer that last one first, and it was, should they act? Should the legislative branch act? And I think that we have a system currently in place, and I believe it should be utilized, that says if the majority of people believe that a judge has interpreted something incorrectly, you should be able to pose a clarifying, amendment to whatever the existing statute is that says that's not how it was intended. Here's how you should be interpreting that. Make it more clear so there is no interpretation available. Now, what I want to come back to, and when I talked earlier about the idea of setting precedent and interpretation, and what you're saying now, would I sponsor a bill that says, hey, you can carry a gun without a permit in all 50 states. They cannot, they can't infringe upon this. Now, here's where it gets a little bit murky, and I'm wondering how I'm sure Kelly's going to jump in on this, because when I see things like the NRA, I'm a member of the NRA, have been for years because it's required for me to be part of my gun club and because they're helping support Second Amendment rights. But the NRA is sponsoring a bill that I actually see as very dangerous to their cause, and I cannot believe no one has jumped on this. And I think most of these gun control advocates are hoping that nobody points this out, but the National Reciprocity Act is the federal government telling the states what they can and cannot do related to concealed carry. So what you're in effect doing is you're now setting a precedent that the federal government can control what the states do related to guns. Now, what happens when you open that door? Like you said, there's a precedent there. That's a slippery slope. So when we talk about setting any precedent at the federal level that increases their control over how the states govern, it has to be done very cautiously, and it has to be done with very clear limitations to where it can be taken.
Well, you've mentioned a word right there that others have not used but is very key to this, which is the idea of precedent, the idea of established past practice, the idea that a mistake can suddenly become codified law that everybody just has to go along with because somebody said so 5 years, 50 years, 100 years ago. Look, if I make a mistake, I smoke cigarettes. That's probably a mistake in most people's eyes, and I'm beginning to wonder at my age whether I should continue with that. But the fact that I have
probably
been doing
Dan.
This for – well, I get it. I've been doing this for any number of years. The precedent I've set, does that mean that I cannot start afresh and say, no, what's the basic founding principle, which is that your body is a temple and you shouldn't defile it? That's a religious view perhaps, but it's certainly a clear view that no scientific person would ever argue with either, that you should take care of what you've got and be healthy. We have precedents on all kinds of things, and there was a Dred Scott precedent that said you could be in a free state and a free man, and they can still make you a slave again. In fact, you never were a free man. There are all kinds of precedents. It used to be that it was illegal to manufacture, deliver, or drink hard liquor in this country, and they repealed that amendment. That was a precedent. It did take an amendment to make it so, and it took an amendment to take it away. But when we're talking about the Constitution, and there was a long discussion earlier on the arguments and the interpretations, I don't understand that one bit. Because when I look at the founding principles, they aren't just what's written in the Declaration and the Constitution. Because those are our established legal documents, the contract, as you mentioned, between the states and the federal government. And according to the Ninth Amendment, the Forgotten Amendment, it's the compact that agrees to the people's right as well. That's all rights which are not specifically enumerated to the federal government belong to the states and the people. But when I read the founders, they were incredibly explicit and prolific and profound. They said everything that could possibly be said as to the why of every single line, every word in the Declaration and the Constitution. There are hundreds of great writers back then. They were
Dan, real quick, finish that up, because I do have another person we want to bring on, and Kel, you're going to intro them, so if we can wrap that up, and then I want to bring him on.
So when
we have plenty of time.
We'll
hopefully we'll be able to bring it back in, bring it back around to that.
All right. So I'll finish it up by just mentioning that when you were talking about the death penalty as being okay because of the cost-benefit analysis of what the benefit or the cost to society would be. But abortion is also okay as long as it's prior to the six-month viability window that apparently exists in some scientists' minds. These are not constitutional principles. These are not about life. If I look at what the founders talked about, they were very clear about almost everything that the federal government should do and should not do. And they were for the death penalty and they were against abortion because babies are innocent, whereas someone who has been convicted and gone through and exhausted all appeals by jury of their peers and according to law and due process may be someone who is worthy of death in their eyes. I personally don't like it because I know governments make mistakes, but would you agree that the founders were entirely clear about what the constitutional compact was meant to be when they talked about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, et cetera, that there really is no gray area, no evolving, and that any precedent that says otherwise is in effect null and void, because if you make a law that disagrees with the basic contract, it's not a law.
Go ahead and answer on that, if you would, James, and then we'll bring in Kelly and introduce our next caller. Go ahead.
Are you there, James?
I'm sorry. I had my phone on mute so that I could take a sip of water.
I'm having a sip of scotch myself.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say, I can't embrace that idea that everything that was put down in that first penning was correct, because then, oh, wait, we forgot to give the individuals, you know, to specify that. So they come and they specifically gave the option for the government to amend what they wrote, because they understood that they couldn't get the entirety of what would exist covered in the words that they originally came up with. They
what would, you
would not
amend?
Have put. Personally, I'm not a big fan of the 16th, but
There you go.
Sure,
that's
that,
a good. I would agree with you there.
I'm not sure that we would ever get weight to overturn it, but I don't believe the federal government was ever meant to be in the taking money from individuals. It's meant to protect, as Kelly said earlier, you know, it's meant to protect this group of states that is giving it power. It's not meant to rule over those states. And, well, as we've talked about, money kind of controls a lot. And, well, if you don't have money, you're not going to do much as a federal government. I don't believe that they covered every particular circumstance, and that's why they put a mechanism in for things to be changed. Otherwise, I mean, we, you know, slaves would still be legal. And, well, I'm glad that they put that in place so that we could change that.
I think if you put on your website, I am in favor of repealing the 16th Amendment and ending the income tax, you would probably get a huge majority of voters, if you could get them to look at that website and read it, who would agree with you 100%.
Well,
and with,
you know,
and with that, I do want to real quick, gentlemen. With that, I do want to bring in Kelly Tindrea Smith's caller. Go ahead, Kelly.
Well, yeah, folks, I've been really enjoying this conversation, and I really like a lot of things Jim has to say. He has a spirit of liberty, obviously. He's articulate. He's just a likable guy, and I want to introduce him to another libertarian, Eric Osborne, here in California. I met Eric at the state convention several weeks ago, and we were like kindred spirits. We've had several several conversations. He doesn't quite agree with the California state platform, and so he wrote his own for Yolo County, which is straight west of Sacramento. And Eric, he's a history teacher. He works at a Christian school. He's a really bright guy, and I'm excited to have him join us and just to get his thoughts. So I guess with that, Eric, just tell us some of your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Eric. Your mic is live.
All right. Good evening, Robert. Thanks for the chance to join the conversation, and thanks for those good words, Kelly. I don't really have a ton of questions. Just a few statements and some encouragement. Mr. Carr, you seem a very articulate, and you come across as a very quality individual. I think Virginia would be fortunate to have you serve them in office. So congratulations on your run for office, and more power to you. As Kelly mentioned, I too am a libertarian, and in my experience, libertarians have positions that many people on both sides like, and then some that lots of people misunderstand and don't like. It seems that we libertarians can equally irritate everyone sometimes, and that's a little bit of a bummer. But you know, having said that, Mr. Carr, I want to encourage you to stick to your guns. Politics is about principle and compromise, and my rule of thumb is never compromise a principle, but there are many ways to carry one out. Now, sometimes you have to take half steps, and liberal purebloods hate that, but they aren't getting things done. You will be if you win election. So by all means, don't go over to the statist dark side, my friend. let the principle of limited government ooze out of every pore so that you tirelessly work towards it. That's the main thing I want to encourage you with.
Well, I absolutely appreciate that, and I will say that I share your sentiment that you need to keep working toward a goal. You need to be directionally correct. And the only way to actually enact change is to understand, as you mentioned there at the beginning, that there are going to be compromises. And as long as you are not compromising that main goal of limiting government, now you're not going to get to a perfect state right away, and some people will accuse you of selling out because you didn't, as we were talking about before, I do favor getting rid of the 16th Amendment and repealing income tax. I favor that. But my fiscal platform that I'm trying to build is going to come up with another option for taxation that actually may have a possibility of getting approved at this point, because we know that there you have to be moving to something better. You can't let perfect be the enemy of better. We need to be working toward better. Now, some people would say we're too far gone and we need to make drastic cuts. We need to make drastic maneuvers. We need to change things wholesale. And we all know that that is great when you're giving a speech to get people riled up, but it's not a practical approach. So I appreciate the encouragement. I've been told by two people after a single event that one person said, well, you know, your speech was kind of watered down, and, you know, I really wish you had been a little bit more fervent on certain issues. And I turned around and talked to somebody else like, dude, you're a little bit over the top. You need to rein it in a little bit. You're going to offend some of these moderates. You can't win with everyone. I really do appreciate the support, because and your words, you know, hearing people that are able to interpret my – I'm not a public speaker. I'm not very comfortable with these sort of discussions. I've always been a rather quiet person. So I hope that when I'm talking that I'm actually coming across as genuine and not as just somebody who's here, you know, spouting off views. And sometimes I wonder that they get a little bit disconnected and you miss the end goal. So for someone to say that I'm articulate, I particularly appreciate that remark, because you never know how it's coming out. It always sounds a little bit different inside your head.
Well, and it sounds like you're working really hard to not step like we do in Yolo County on some of the humongous landmines of the culture wars. I mean, and abortion is the biggest A-bomb of the culture wars. And, you know, they've been fighting it for 20 to 40 years now, and it sure seems like nobody is winning. Nobody really changes the thinking of the other side. They just whip up more and more opposition and hatred towards each other. And
well, Eric, let me ask you a question. It's Kelly here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned, you know, the state sovereignty quiz, and we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. You and I calling on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about that position of the federal government hands off, let the states decide? What's your thoughts on that kind of a position?
Well, my thoughts are the same as the framers, that the states are sovereign communities, and the federal government exists to provide a limited framework for common defense and to get in there when two states are fighting about something and there's some kind of a problem. And I do not believe that the founders ever intended for our government, our federal government, to have such a far reach, and for states' rights really to be really just kind of a laughing stock. And they really have been since the Civil War. And I think it's time to go back to the way it was. I think it's time to recapture that way of thinking. And so one of the things in Yolo County that we're really committed to doing is the whole idea of education, trying to get people to remember or to relearn what liberty really means, what government is supposed to really do, what freedom is all about, what tolerance is, what are the rights of the individual? What are rights and what aren't rights? Because people throw that word around all the time, and they obviously are abusing the word. So we're working really hard at trying to change that mindset that the statist folks have been working very hard for, you know, 70, 80 years or more to, you could almost say brainwash most of our society. And we're trying to work really hard, because at the same time we want to try to elect people, we also have to recognize that, you know, those few guys that are going to get elected, and let's hope it's four times what we think it'll be, but they're going to be like guys standing on the shore with BB guns trying to stop an aircraft carrier. You know, the status behemoth is huge, and it is almost past the tipping point. And we need warriors, so to speak, you know, people who will go and fight for those principles. But if the rest of us aren't behind them promoting this huge wave of grassroots re-education, if you want to call it that, then they're not going to get anywhere. And so we're working very hard in our county for that.
One thing I want to chime in, because I don't know how much more time, and if we'd appreciate if you can't stay longer, James, I'm sure there's plenty to talk about, but in case your time is limited, I do want to get a couple questions out myself before moving on, is that talking about states' rights, especially in the issue, the two issues that are important here with abortion and marriage, is that they mentioned if a state – now, we sounds like we know what your personal stances on the two issues are. And that being said, and what we – you know, with what we've read earlier, is that if a state was to say, okay – like Ohio, for instance. Ohio right now does not recognize same-sex marriage. However, there was a judge that said that they must. So if a state says that it cannot – you know, they will not recognize them, and the judge says that, well, whose side would you lean on, the even, you know, with state sovereignty and states' rights taken into consideration?
Well, you know, that's a difficult issue. It really is. I do say unequivocally that I don't think the federal government belongs in any of that. And I don't think the state government really should get involved in those affairs either. What people do on a on a consensual, contractual basis with one another is not the sphere of government. And if there is going to be any kind of limitations or any kind of adjustment to what people wish to do, I think that's best done at the lowest possible level, and that would be even the community or the county level. Because there
let's take it to that level. Let's say a county decides that a county is not going to accept, you know, same-sex marriage. Would that be something? And then the state government said, no, you have to accept this. Would you agree with that then? Or, and also with abortion, let's say Ohio decides that abortion should be illegal, and the state and the federal government steps in and says, well, no, you have to make it legal in Ohio. Would you side with for the sovereignty or with the federal government?
Okay, Robert, I just got to interrupt this. I'm sorry. All right, C-13 of the Magna Carta, okay? The Magna Carta was the first time in modern history the law was placed above the king. It was at a cost of the blood and the sword. And the barons told England, King John or bad King John, look, you can control London. We don't care. In our counties, in our towns, in our villages, you will respect our local customs. And where I'm going with this is I tripped up a diehard conservative Republican once. I said, look, let's suppose that in a locality they passed a no abortion ordinance. The liberals screamed, and they said, okay, let's go to the state. And the state said, oh, overturn it. You must have abortions here. Well, then the pro-lifers went to the, you know, they lost, so they went to the lower court, and they won. Okay, locality, yeah, you can outlaw abortions. And then the liberals took it to the federal government, and they won. It says, okay, yeah, abortion, you must do it in your locality. Then I told my friend, look, suppose we go to the UN, and the UN then said, abortion is outlawed worldwide. Is that a good idea? And she said, yes. I said, no, it's not. In order for them to pass a law, we must give them sovereignty at the UN level. It comes down to, as I've been preaching, sovereignty. That's the bottom line.
Well, so I want to throw in a
so where does sovereignty? Here's the question, Kelly, and I pose it to everyone. Where does sovereignty start? Are you talking about county sovereignty? You can go from city sovereignty, and you can talk to village sovereignty. I mean, you could take it to neighborhood sovereignty if you want to take it to a ridiculous level. But where do you get to the point where, you know, you break it down to its, you know, smallest denominator? When you talk about sovereignty and who can say, you need to do this.
I would chime in that I would start where the Mayflower Compact started. And I know that seems kind of a strange place to start, but in the Mayflower Compact, you had a community of people, and they bound themselves together to create, you know, a community. And they said, we agree to have what little rules and what little laws we have to have, and we'll meet together from time to time, but not very often. I mean, you get this whole idea of limited. We're not going to do this a lot. And we pledge to cooperate whenever those decisions have been made by the body politic. And I think the spirit of that is what we've lost badly. And so when you add the idea that, well, sovereignty starts with the individual, and as you have a group of individuals, you have to exist in such a way that you can exercise your rights as long as you do no harm to somebody else. And, you know, sometimes we don't recognize we're going to do harm, and it takes some neighbors to say, dude, don't do that. And that's where I think it you have the greatest chance of compassionate and realistic and intelligent, limitations, if you will. And the other thing that I sometimes find is a winning argument on others, the other side, is the idea of disenfranchisement. Americans just really hate that idea. And so the way I look at it is, well, when the federal government passes, bans something, or particular bans a practice that people have in their, they want to have in a relationship, then they've disenfranchised everyone in the whole country. If you want to practice that, you got to go out of the country. If they do it at the state level, well, now the Mississippians can do it, but the people in Ohio can't. Okay, well, you've disenfranchised everyone in Ohio, and they got to move out of the state. Well, that's kind of a hardship. Maybe that's not such a good idea. If you do it down at the community level, you have the least amount of disenfranchisement, because and when you get together in those town hall meetings and somebody wants to ban such and such a thing, they've got to stare at the people who are living that way, and they got to see them in the face. You also have the greatest chance to come to a genuine compromise and to see things through each other's eyes. And then if it really comes down to it and there's some kind of a ban or some kind of prohibition, they're not as disenfranchised. In Woodland, we live about 8-10 miles away from another community called Davis, and it's very different from Woodland in a lot of ways. If Woodland decided they wanted to outlaw something like gay marriage, and Davis didn't, well, if people in Woodland would not be that disenfranchised, it's only 8 miles down the road. If you're going to have to do something like that, and I say if you're going to have to do something like that, that seems to me the least egregious way to do it, rather than have it done, in Sacramento so that 30 million Californians now have to knuckle under whether they like it or not, or they have to move. And well, to me, I can see why that becomes a big fighting point.
Well, Robert,
I want to hear from Dan. Go ahead.
I've been listening very carefully, and I hear a lot of debate, but you guys may not realize you're actually agreeing on some very basic principles. For instance, the idea of gradualism has been tossed about, and it did take not 80 years, but a lot longer for the so-called progressives. They're not really progressives.
Yeah.
They're not really liberals. The statists to get to us to where we're at. And in the same argument, I hear, we're so close to statism taking over completely right now. So I'm wondering if there's time enough for the other side of reasonableness to have a gradual change back to what we're supposed to be. I don't think there is. I think it's going to require radical thought. Now, as to which issues are the most important, I think the most important issues are the issues where we're compromising on principle. I agree with Mr. Carr and with the other guests that there's no problem with compromise. I don't have all the answers to every single thing. Which issue is the most important to go for at the moment, and what way should we go after that issue? What's the best method to solve a problem? There are a lot of people out there who aren't even in politics or haven't even thought of it yet. However, they might look at that problem fresh, and just have one of those V8 moments where they just say, hey, why don't we try this? And we all go, well, why the heck didn't the rest of us think about it? Mm-hmm. There is no time left. And I think that when we talk about sovereignty, the individual is what the Constitution was designed to protect. The Bill of Rights was about the individual's sovereignty. It didn't say the government does this for you, the government does this for you, that for you. It said the government cannot do this to you. And ultimately, you cannot have a government that is fair, that is honest, that is decent, that is constitutional, at least not in America, unless it is a voluntary agreement, a compact between individuals to have someone represent them and to have these representatives in open debate make decisions, and then for us to decide whether we agree with them or not. For a long time, the reason that these so-called progressives were able to get away with what they did is because they did brainwash us. They took over the schools. They own them. And they took over the medias. They own it. And they made politics boring, and they made it difficult to understand. If you pass a one-page law that simply says that the 16th Amendment is abolished, you make an amendment, the 16th Amendment is gone, there is no IRS, that's very clear. You could probably write it like all the other amendments in 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 paragraphs. That's all it would take. On the other hand, you could make a 2,000-page bill and put all kinds of stuff in there, and then as the executive decide you don't even want to obey the own law, the law that carries your own name, as our current administrator is doing. I'm reminded of what George Washington said about government. See, there are a lot of libertarians that I know personally in my area who get so full of the ideal of individual sovereignty that they can't accept any strictures on them whatsoever. And I'm with them in spirit, and I'm willing voluntarily to give up a little bit of my sovereignty on specific matters for specific reasons so that we can get specific things done. I'm willing to say that, now I don't agree with speed limits on major highways, but in a city or a town where there are, you know, two lanes and cars parked there and little kids and old people and cross streets and parking lots and people coming in and out, I think it's entirely wise to have laws that say you can't zoom through there, you know, slaloming around school buses at 90 miles an hour. That's a clear danger to people who don't want to put themselves in danger. On the other hand, there are a lot of things that are regulated right now. But just about everything is regulated right now that absolutely have no effect on public safety or the public good in any meaningful way. And there'd be little or no harm if people would simply be freed of these useless regulations and subject to criminal penalties if they actually committed a crime, if they actually committed a tort, if they harmed someone physically or harmed them through business fraud. So what Washington said, he used the analogy of fire. And he compared government to fire because he said it was a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. So if you're elected, and I certainly wish you all the luck in the world, especially if you're running against Cantor, because the man started off sounding like a real Tea Party guy, and he has a postcard check. He's for right to work. He's for school choice. On the other hand, he's for the Dream Act, the Dream Amnesty, and he's pushing through bills in extremely unconstitutional and improper ways. He was just at that summit on Amelia Island in Florida with former Representative La Tourette from Ohio, Bob, which was anti-Tea Party, sponsored by the so-called Main Street Partnership. The corrupt unions, the rhinos, and George Soros, for God's sakes. I mean, you can judge somebody by their associations. If you're taking his money, he's getting something for it. So I appreciate, Mr. Carr, the fact that you're willing to compromise on details and you're willing to be open to debate. That's a major function of a legislature, is to listen and to work out details. So a lot of these issues facing us aren't necessarily quite simple, but some of them are going to require bold and drastic action. We cannot permit patriots of the left or of the right or of the center who are just ordinary Americans to be declared to be felons simply because they don't turn in a gun. We cannot permit, and I'm sorry if you don't agree with this, innocent children who have never committed a crime to have their lives terminated simply because of inconvenience. And the argument about health of the mother, according to doctors such as Ben Carson and other well-respected, he's a brain surgeon, but really, really top-notch medical scientific people, is that it's very rare that it affects the life of the mother in any meaningful way that can't be ameliorated. It does sometimes happen. That's a very difficult choice. I'm not sure what the answer is in those cases. However, most mothers in those cases choose to put their own lives at risk, as most fathers would do if their families were threatened. So there are some things where if we allow that slippery slope to continue, it's going to push us that last inch off the cliff, cliff now. So I would urge you, sir, to make up your mind about which issues you think are going to be the winning issues, the crucial issues, and go full bore with those. I understand that you will have a lot of people who are supposedly moderates who won't vote for you. I got news for you, sir. They won't vote for anybody because they don't vote.
Hey, Kelly here. Robert, can I talk a little bit now?
Sure, go ahead, Kelly.
All right. Well, I want to bring up some big, big picture items, okay? And, you know, I am a pro-life guy, okay? That's just me. And again, federal government doesn't belong in the bedroom, the womb, or the vein. All right. Two main issues. One, this issue, social issues, have been used by the puppets, the R's and the D's, they're puppeteers, to divide us. Rick Santorum gets in a pickup truck, goes through Iowa, I'm pro-life, and he wins. You know, first it was Romney, but yeah, they recounted it was Rick Santorum. Okay. And then he votes for the NDAA and the Patriot Act. Are you out of your freaking mind? Did he read the Constitution? And somebody had to confront him and say, look, you're not a natural born citizen. That's why he resigned his campaign.
Hey, Kelly.
The guy's not reading
the
Constitution.
Just to let you know one thing, Santorum was a senator here in Pennsylvania, and after one term, we kicked him out and never let him back. And, you know, that's a really good practice with a lot of politicians.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, that's my first point. My second point, if I may.
I got to get this out, Kelly, when it's on topic. And it only takes a few seconds, and because I know folks listening here also are probably listening to Rush Limbaugh. But this is what Rush Limbaugh said, it's only 30 seconds, about Rick Santorum on the day of the Florida primary in 2012. You just got to hear it.
By the way, folks, just I have to remind you again that Gingrich debated John Kerry on global warming at one point, and they agreed on practically every point. Nobody is innocent. Everybody is guilty of some transgression at somewhere against conservatism, except Santorum. See you tomorrow.
Rush Limbaugh said that when, Rush Limbaugh said that about Santorum when Gingrich was, you know, on a roll. It looked like he could, could possibly win. We know Rush Limbaugh, whatever, no matter what anyone says, is influential. You know, in politics, and there in Florida,
Bob.
They say he's in entertainment, he definitely still has influence there. But
even Rush Limbaugh, you know, and I know people probably hate me for this, but even he has been known to make mistakes, and that was one.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, anyway, so my first point is: look, these social issues at the federal level are dividing people, and people get elected. They don't diddly squat about the Constitution. Point number two. You look at the Communist Manifesto. How do you take over a country? Implement a central bank, grab a hold of industry and private property in the hands of the government. We're going there quickly. All right. The big one is centralization of power. Centralization of power. That's what we're fighting. And they've been at this for how many decades? Then they use the social issues to centralize power with idiots who don't know the Constitution. Those are my two points. That's why I like libertarians, even though they've got some, you know, little things that I disagree with. But we can mitigate all this by taking the social issues out of the hands of the federal government and let the states decide. That's how we mitigate it. We don't get into arguments very much. Oh, state sovereignty? Never thought about that. Yes, it's our history. It's our Constitution. It's the way it was. It's like we get these issues, the social issues, out of the hands of the federal government. Even I'm hoping libertarians, even if they disagree in their social issues and state-by-state platform, at least they respect. They respect each other's states' rights, and they're not going to go into codependent mode by trying to change other states on their social platform. Respect our sovereignty.
State-by-state, keep it out of the federal government. But if a state says, you know, like here in Ohio, I mean, that's what the state says, and then for a federal judge to try to overturn that, I think going all the way down to the county level, you know, borders on, you know, I just think borders are ridiculous. I think it's be too micro, you know, managed.
Right,
you know,
it's hard practically, but right. It's hard practically, but it dissolves the centralization of power that the socialists are trying so damn hard to do.
Well, that's really what we need in representatives and senators and in 2016 a president in Washington, D.C., and we need this in every one of our state houses as well, is people who do not pass new laws. They do not pass new rules, new regulations, new strictures on liberty. What they do is keep the basic ones that we all agree, because it's foolish not to. It's got to be illegal to hit someone on the head with a stick or shoot them or stab them unless you're defending your life or the life of someone else, period. There's no one who's going to argue with that. It's got to be illegal to lie in a commercial speech or misrepresent yourself in a contract or fail to honor a contract, tort law. That makes perfect sense. The rest of it, almost all of it, is just a word that I'm not going to say on the radio. It's a word, well, I'm sure you've got your own words. So what we need is representatives to go in there and do the really brave thing and not make a name for themselves by, look, I passed a law that says that there's mandatory reporting of this, that, or the other thing, or there's mandatory, you have to get a license to be a barber. You have to get a license to be a massage therapist. You got to get a license to sell real estate. You know what? You don't need a license for all these things. You don't need to go to school for these things. There's very few things besides driving a CDL or operating an aircraft or being a brain surgeon that you have to have so much technical knowledge and prove that you have that knowledge. You know what? If I want to go into business, I don't need a license. I need insurance. And any fool who does business with me when I don't have proper insurance and bonding should not complain if I mess up. On the other hand, if I promise that I'm going to build someone a porch, it better be built, and it better be built according to the contract. Otherwise, they can take me to court. So what you're going to have to do, Mr. Carr, assuming that you get elected, is to get in there and get rid of a lot of stuff. The federal code runs to millions of pages now. Millions. I mean, not the U.S. Code, but all the regulations that have been written on top of the U.S. Code. The Congress has been consistently giving away their constitutional statutory authority to unelected boards like the Federal Reserve. Right now, the EPA has just declared that any piece of land that ever gets wet at all, if it gets rain, if there's dew that forms in the morning, if once a year there's a big rainstorm and some water runs off from another property, they have jurisdiction. The law that was written said that the federal government, and this is constitutional, has control over navigable waterways. And that is to ensure the national security and to ensure interstate commerce, because rivers are an efficient method of transportation. We still use them, and they cross all the different political boundaries. Everything else has to go. So I know you may not have the answers right now, but if you come up with a list, and I think you should, of specific legislation, and not little ones, but wholesale, that has to go. If we get patriots in there, and I think we will, if we take back the Senate, bolster the House, start impeaching possibly the president, certainly the attorney general, any number of other federal officials and judges for breaching their oath of office, and give them a fair trial in the Senate and get rid of them, because there many of them are guilty of sin, then it's not enough to start gradual, because that won't work. We're going to have to wholesale start cutting things. And it's going to be tough, but our choice is very clear. Are we going to suffer for a limited period of time for a specific purpose to restore people's rights, their liberty, and therefore give the people a chance to restore prosperity, which they will. We've done it before. We can do it again. Or are we going to suffer endlessly? And those little children that you have, Mr. Carr, I'm absolutely certain that you love them. And I'm absolutely certain that you want them to have every possible opportunity in life to do whatever they want with their life. And looking at your family situation, I know that you would accept your children's decisions regardless of whether it met with your own personal philosophies. You know, if your kid turns out to be gay or something like that, you're still going to love them. Of course you will. And if we do not start being bolder, if we do not start risking angering those people who are uninformed or who think that their views of moderation are somehow reasonable, there is no chance. We have about another year or less to start pushing everything in the other direction in a big way, and then it's going to take a concerted effort of at least 4 to 6 years, period. If we don't do it, we lose. The rest of the world is starting to turn into a tyranny. We're starting to resemble 1939, and if this country isn't the bulwark of liberty and freedom, that's it for the rest of the world, too. And with technology the way it is these days, what they're coming up with, there is a significant chance that there will never be another revolt again, that in another generation or less, there won't be a free thought, that there won't be a person out there who has any idea what it's like to think freely, that their thoughts will be monitored, their thoughts will be controlled. They have electronic means, they have pharmacological means, and this stuff sounded like real wild conspiracy stuff just a few years ago, and now it's in the mainstream press, it's on every place you look, and it's not science fiction anymore. We're there. So the idea of gradualism and not offending people, that's got to go, sir. It's just got to go. If you want to be elected and do something... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Dan, I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. I know when we're talking about the political process, gradualism, there's a great need for it. However, the thing that really doesn't get talked about very much, you could call it the elephant in the room, is the fact that there are really two governments. There's the government we see, and we're talking to somebody who wants to be elected to it, and then there's the real government, which is all the bureaucracy behind all of that. And they've been entrenched there for a long time. They will fight to the death for their jobs. And that's going to be a tough fight. Yeah, I absolutely agree. We have a local radio talk show host that calls himself the Cowboy Libertarian.
Fire them, sir, and see what they do.
Yeah, that's exactly what we need to do.
I work in the unemployment office.
They don't let you do that.
One at a time, guys. You're talking over each other. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you fire them, I work in the unemployment office. They'll get 6 months of unemployment and job training. And good luck to them. And if they want to stay in the office, you can evict them. Because the power is not in who wields the power. The power is, it's not in who says they have the power. It's in who wields it. At this stage, right now, if you get in this year and are in January 20th, you're sworn into office and you join a lot of other patriots who will agree with you on some matters, disagree with you on others, compromise with you on still more matters. At that point, if you take bold action and if you close the Department of Education and you say there is no more Department of Education, you get your pensions, whatever we've agreed to, you get whatever is coming to you that we've already signed contracts for, you get your unemployment, and good luck, get a job. You were not coming back into that department. It doesn't exist anymore. What are they going to do, camp out in the office and say, yes, we do? If you say,
well,
we aren't funding.
In fact, they have done things very much like that, very similar. The SEIU, I think is the initials, they're very powerful, and nobody crosses them without getting a bruising, you know, that's the scary part. So Mr. Carr is going to, heading into a tough job.
I sued SEIU in 2012 and cost them over $1 million in 2013. And if they want to bruise me, they know where to find me every single day.
All right. Good job. Great job.
James, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just saying, I agree with the idea that we need to start turning this ship around. But the idea that we're going to take the Titanic and turn it 90 degrees in a year or two, I think it's unrealistic. I think we need to start identifying big cuts. We need to start making big cuts. But we have to do so in such a way. It's I've used this analogy before, and we are a country of addicts. We are addicted to, and not by our own personal preference, but we are addicted to a federal government of large spending. And with any addict, there are very few that can survive cold turkey withdrawal without a good methodical plan to get them back on a good path. What we need to do, instead of just saying we are going to get rid of, and this is where I'm going to disagree slightly, that we can't say, all right, Department of Education is gone, good luck, and move on. We have to have a plan. We have to have a methodology for doing that and for, because the states are not prepared. They are not ready to accept that responsibility. So you have to have a transition plan, because who are ultimately going to pay for us cutting, and I would say actually that with Department of Education right now, they're not exactly adding a whole lot to the education system. But if we cut them, then we are actually putting the states at a point where they say, well, what do we do now? They do handle those. Excuse me?
Go ahead,
it's real simple, sir. Okay, I just have to chime in here. You cut the Department of Education while you simultaneously reduce the amount of taxes coming from the states. If you continue taking that money in, you give it back to them in block grants to be used specifically for education, and you let them decide. Every single state has its own Department of Education. Every single community has a school district and a school board, which they do know and they do elect, and they have plans in place. They have school books. There's absolutely no reason why they couldn't take over the reins immediately.
So I actually consider what you just said to be a phased approach, because what you are saying is not you are reducing the federal taxes. You're saying you're still going to take those federal taxes, and now you're going to give them back to the states. And what I am proposing is we need to be moving to a point where the states are actually – the federal government never gets to touch that money, because just in that act alone, there is inherent inefficiency. So – if we're going to move to a more state-central, a more sovereign state-controlled approach, you have to have a method in place for the states to handle. One, they need to increase their tax approach. They need to have more control over their tax approach. We reduce the federal taxes immediately, absolutely. But I'm not a huge proponent of saying we're going to get rid of this. We're still going to let the federal government take the money, and hopefully they're going to give it back to the states, because we know what normally happens.
Then cut the taxes.
Cut the taxes. But you have to have the states prepared, and I do not believe any of the states would have, you know, if we said tomorrow, by the way, in 2015, we're no longer taking X amount out of your tax base. You figure out how to get it in and support your school systems. You're not getting any more federal funding. It is on you. I don't know.
Sir,
that there are many states that would be ready to...
You trust individuals. You don't trust the people that we elect as state houses and state senates and governors. I'm not too happy with our current crop of Republicans and Democrats here in Pennsylvania. However, these are people we know, and they're just as smart as anybody in Washington. How many years are you going to give it on each one of these issues? Are we going to spend 2 years on education, maybe 3 years, maybe 4 years, and then we'll spend 2 years or 3 years or 4 years on energy, and then 2 years or 3 years or 4 years on IRS? And by the time we get there, we won't get there. We won't get there,
I'm
sir.
Not
it's,
talking
I
about a
faster.
Serial approach. Yeah, well, you're assuming that I'm talking about a serial approach.
Well, please tell us
what
is your approach.
A lot of these go in parallel. You start to identify where we need to make these cuts, how we can transition it to the state, and come up with an approach. You know, unfortunately, like I said, I am not a politician. I do not have all of the data that I need to actually, and the reason I don't have my fiscal platform fully defined is because I don't actually have access to all of the data that I need to finalize some of these details. What I want to do is get more control to the states. How do you do that? I think it's a two-year approach. It takes that long. One, you have to define what is the budget going to be. Most of the states, by the time we're talking right now about next year, well, the states are already building their budgets for next year. They should be. They should already be thinking about it. I know every business is. If you say we're going to change something next year and just hack it off, that is a very disruptive process for the states, the ones that we're trying to put the power back to. So you actually need to say, okay, by the way, next budgeting cycle, you need to be able to plan for this. So you have to be able to approve it in 1 year, and you need them to have time, have it approved in time for them to actually correctly assess their, during their budgeting cycle, the impact of this, so that they can change how they're going to apply taxes, get in the revenue they need, without burdening the individual.
So you're talking about a 2 year parallel graduated approach where you give advance notice to the states that they're going to have to step up and take over responsibility. And then after that period of time, the first year, you actually budget less, you take less, you abolish some of the federal authority and assume that they're going to do whatever they do. And there'll be some successes and some failures out there, I'm sure. That is the kind of approach we're looking for.
That's what I'm trying to propose. It's not that you can say this year we're just going to change it and good luck. You need to work with the states so that they are able to accommodate this change. Because, well, let's face it, if we just hack everything out of the federal budgets, there are a lot of things. The states are not going to be prepared to take on everything all at once. But there are a lot of things that you can do in parallel as long as they have ample opportunity to plan, to staff up. You know, it's not going to be a zero-sum game, but there's certainly going to be a lot of the person.
Most of our states don't need to staff up. There's like 80,000 government employees. Is it 60 or 80,000 in Pennsylvania? I'm one of them. I'm low paid. But we don't really need more employees, and we really don't need more intrusion on any level. But 2 years is a reasonable approach. That's one election cycle. One of the political realities is that if you have a mandate from the voters, if there's a big sweeping change, and I feel it coming this year and in 2016, and you don't take advantage of it, you lose the momentum. That momentum has been gradually building on the statist side to a point where it's threatening to overwhelm everyone with a tsunami of absolute tyranny. We don't have time for gradualism.
I hate to say this, but we've got only about, I'd even say, 10 minutes before I have to, at the most, start to shut things down for the night. I'm sure we probably have enough conversation left in us to last at least another hour, as we see that happen a lot here on Bard's Logic. But unfortunately, we don't have the time, and be great if we can have this conversation again on another show, and perhaps we'll be able to set something up for that. But with that being said, the number of us on the line, and so what I want to do is go ahead and you finish your point, Dan, and then I want to bring in and open up the mic for a couple minutes, because that's all we'll have for each person, to Eric and then to Kelly, and then we'll give some closing thoughts from you, James, and then I'll have to close out the show. So go ahead, Dan, I'll finish the point, and then we'll bring in Eric, and then Kelly, and then you, James, and then, of course, as I said, we only each got about a couple minutes. So go ahead, Dan.
Well, I think my point is pretty clear, so I don't need to take up more valuable time. And plus, I really like to hear Eric. He's a new voice on the show and a very interesting fellow. So please, Eric, go ahead and say what you need to say.
I appreciate that, Dan. Well, I guess in just by way of closing, you know, Dan, you say you had some very interesting things to say. I agree with you in so many different things that you said tonight. There are times when my heart gets very dark about the state of our poor country, and I try real hard to be optimistic about what we can do to turn things around. So I guess I sometimes call myself a cynical optimist, which is really weird. But so I want to have hope that the system can somehow be repaired and purged, and you know, it reminds me of the Puritans and the Separatists in England in the 1600s. You know, the Puritans wanted to cleanse the Church of England from within, you know, get reforms, and the Separatists basically said, it's a lost cause, it's too far gone, we're going to America and starting over. And I can understand now, more than ever, those two different ways of thinking. There's a part of me that wants to work with Mr. Carr and try to fix this. This is a wonderful country. It is the bastion of liberty. And then there are times when I look at it and say, oh, man, we're like 100 years too late, and I don't know if we can get this done. But I do believe there is a way for it to happen. And I think what I've heard here tonight is encouraging to me, but it's going to be a very difficult fight, not only because of numbers, but because of the apathy of the American public, though they are starting to be awakened, and they're starting to be really angry. We run into that all the time. When we were at the Yolo County Fair, and we had our fair booth, and we were registering people for the party and, you know, just talking and getting to know people, we found an equal number of people completely ticked off from both the left and the right. It was fascinating. It was almost exactly even. So there are a lot of angry people out there, and if we can engage them and link arms with them about the things that we can link arms with them about, then we have a force to be reckoned with. But then there are times when I think of things like what Mark Levin has proposed in having a constitutional convention called by the states to just do an end run around the federal government, because it's kind of stupid to think that they're going to reform themselves. So the states should take care of that. I like that idea. I've read his book. Boy, has it got a lot of merit if you can get it done. I like what Kelly Mordecai wrote about the grand jury and how that really is another way we can curb and control and take apart some of the bureaucratic abuse of power and you know, breaking of the law and just getting away with it. And I'm encouraged that local towns and counties and even states can start educating themselves on the power of the grand jury to really do the work of protecting the citizens. And I think these are two things that are out there that give me some sense of hope, but it's going to be a tough battle. So, Mr. Carr, please, gird yourself up. Put on the armor, because you're going to have to do battle, and it's not going to be easy. And best of luck to you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. I hope to hear you again on the show. You're, of course, more than welcome to call back, and we are live every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and we do occasional Friday evening shows. We may do one either this Friday or next Friday. Actually, probably next Friday is more likely because, unfortunately, I get to get up quite early on Saturdays, but we still may attempt to do that. I get to find some logistics on what we were going to do, if we do it this Friday or next. We're talking about doing some money bombs for Mitch McConnell's opponents, who we had on last week, and that is Matt Bevin. So for folks interested in listening to that show, we have it on archive next week. But go ahead, Kelly. We've got about a couple minutes there, then we want to leave some closing thoughts from James, and then I'll have to close up the show for the evening.
Well, I just want to say, wow, what a show. We've had people about tripping over each other to say some things, and you know, I really like libertarians. They have got liberty at heart. They understand this stuff. I've learned some things from them. They learned some things from me. This ain't like the R's and the D's or the donkeys and the elephants, you know, those guys. I'm just, like, stunned. And, you know, we had a great guest, very articulate, very sharp, seriously thinking through, you know, what he's coming into. And you know, I keep looking at the I want to call it insane, but it's so insane I have trouble wrapping my mind around it, the insane brilliance of the Founding Fathers and what they put together. And how do we get back to that? How do we, you know, of course, one of my strategies, state sovereignty, is just take the social issues, put them aside on the federal level. And how do we, you know, Eric's got some really good practical points, and that's what's great about getting people together who really like liberty. We can exchange ideas, learn from each other, and move forward. And I'm glad that Mr. Carr was able to spend time with us tonight.
And I think that's
your cue,
James. Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, guys, I really do want to thank you for having me on. This has been a great discussion. You know, here on the East Coast, 5:30 comes pretty early, so I was kind of wondering if I would start trailing off. But this has been a very invigorating conversation. You know, I took my licks with the little quiz that, you know, I'm probably going to hold that against you for a little while, Kelly, but maybe I'll let go.
That's right.
Most people
don't
want
to follow that quiz.
Yeah. You're talking the quibbling the facts and the details, right? But it's the life we live in. We need to be paying attention to the details. So to lead into some of the details real quick, that I've got to do the plug about the campaign. I've got to come back to what it is that I'm trying to do, this mountain that I want to climb. And I'm really hoping that some of the listeners and some of the panelists would be willing. You mentioned my personal blog, which is out there, absolutely. But I do have my official campaign page up and running. I'm working on transferring all of the blog details over. And the recommendation earlier to say have a couple of, you know, a short sentence or two on an issue and then a link to another page with the details. Well, that's actually what I do have on the official campaign page, which is jamescarrforcongress.org. I also have on there, for anyone that happens to be in the 7th District of Virginia that's listening, links to events that I'm going to be at, a link to download our petition form. Because none of this really does any good if I can't get on the ballot and give the voters the option to vote differently. Right now, it looks like it's going to be the winner of the Brat Cantor primary on the ballot. I am working. Hopefully after this weekend, I'm going to be I'm planning on being about three-quarters of the way to the goal. But every signature counts. Please, if you're in the 7th District, go out, get some signatures. Come to the event. Help me. I've got several clipboards. We're going to have people. We got an Earth Day event this weekend with 7,000 people where we've got a booth set up. So and this is going to, you know, this is the thing that as I've been talking, people keep reminding me, hey, you didn't mention that you've got to pay bills as this campaign goes along, because as a libertarian, the idea of, you know, an individual sovereignty, the idea of personal accountability, you think, well, I do it myself. Well, the fact is we have three kids in daycare. My wife and I both work to handle our mortgage, daycare, car bills. I am not independently wealthy, and I'm not going to be able to carry this campaign out of, you know, our meager savings. So I do need to rely on people who are willing to go online. I've got a link to PayPal.
Yes,
we're going to have Bitcoin. We're going to have Bitcoin up very soon, and I am looking for. You know, we have people. I've had $5, $4 here, $20 donations. There are, some people are coming in with a little bit more, but it's the those are the ones that really mean something to me, because they're people that, that they can't afford much, but they understand that it's going to help the campaign. It's not going into my pocket, I guarantee you. Right now, I've been I need to order some more bumper stickers. You know, little things like that that actually make a big difference to a campaign. $20 here or there makes it. I actually put on one of the pages, I said, here's what I get for a $5, a $10, a $20 donation. Here's what I'm able to supply the campaign with. And as we get further along, it's going to be pretty necessary. So if you're willing, you know, go out there and look at a little bit more of the details on my site and see if you could throw, you know, a couple of dollars towards the cause. That would be great. So that, man, that was just painful to even go through. I really hate that part.
No,
but it's
have
necessary.
I completely understand, but definitely necessary. And unfortunately, it's necessary for me to do this part, which is painful for me every Wednesday.
Don't do it,
Bob. At this time. And that is to say, it is time for me to close out the show. I'll be doing that. And we'll see you guys next Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern time. Call in and share the link tonight to hear about your campaign and hear about Mr. Carr's campaign here. And so I will end tonight as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. So thank you, everyone, again. Thank you, Mr. Carr, for coming in and spending as much time as you did with us tonight, and to all of our panelists, guests, and audience. So take care.
Thank
you, Mr. Carr. Good night. We'll see you next time.
Good night, folks.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.